Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's go back to 2011. Look at the World Cup with Squidge. Let's go back. Oh baby, let's go back with Squidge.
We made it. We got there. This is it. This is the day everyone who's tuned into this podcast in the past, over the past...
dies.
40... Thank you. Yes. That past 47... That would be really, really dramatic. Yeah. This is the podcast. This is like an episode of Black Mirror.
Yeah.
A podcast that... What if a podcast could do crime? There you are, Charlie Brooker. Have that one for free. Yeah. You're listening to the Squidge Rugby World Cup retrospective that's finally got to the final of the 2011 Rugby World Cup. I had a moment early today as I was watching this final back, right? At half time, I paused it to try and book my vaccination. And that felt properly like the end of an era, didn't it? You know, we spent lockdown doing this podcast, and now I was not only able to not book my vaccination because I had run into a technical difficulty, I was also able to watch the final back in full and then sit down and record this podcast.
Yeah, it feels really, really bizarre that we've made the final, and it's been a really quite spectacular journey.
Yes, of 47 games leading into this. And it has that thing that I love thinking this when watching World Cup finals back. I remember allowing myself to have this thought during the 2019 final, watching that live, of every game, you know, you stop and you think about, you know, in that World Cup, like Uruguay against Australia, you know, every single game there was lead. That was just a completely random example for 2019, was leading into that final, you know, like every moment of it was about a team, every team trying to get into that. Yeah. And every then beat of that final comes from this kind of pyramid of everything underneath it building up to it.
Yeah.
So every episode we've done, even, you know, the likes of USA, Russia, Georgia, Romania, South Africa, 87, Namibia, nil, you know, all of those were leading into this. All of those meant that this could happen, and this wouldn't have happened without all of them.
It is crazy that we've had 20 teams, you know, we said goodbye to 12 of them in the group stage, and now we've got, you know, the two best teams in the tournament going head to head. It's... I'm excited to talk about this final.
So, can I begin with a controversial statement?
Hang on. Who are you?
Oh, I'm Robbie or Squidge or whatever you want to call me. Who are you?
I'm Will Owen.
Good. We probably should have met before we started the podcast.
Yeah, man. Like maybe, especially the last episode of the podcast.
We should have done it on like episode one, I think.
Yeah.
At least by episode three or four.
Yeah. Like, let alone 48. Like,
okay. We were bonded enough by watching England-Argentina on episode five that should have done it, really. We should have met there. We should have said names, you know. But it kind of gets awkward after a certain point. You can't really ask.
Compared to England-Argentina, you're quite interesting.
Oh, wow. Thank you. That's a very low bar, but I'll take it. Compared to Georgia-Romania, you register on the map. So
give me some hot takes, bro.
So I want to offer you a very hot take right off the bat, you know.
We better go for it, man.
Normally, we wait about half an hour before doing hot takes.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
But I think this World Cup final...
This better not be about films.
2011 is not as good as The Godfather. No, actually, I disagree with that statement. I think this World Cup final, 2011, is my favourite Rugby World Cup final.
Okay, I was thinking that. I think this might be my favourite match of rugby ever.
Really?
That doesn't involve Wales.
That's it, you've got... I say that as a neutral, as someone that doesn't have an emotional attachment.
I would say objectively rather than final, like subjectively with like an emotional attachment of, I like this game because Wales beat England 30-3. And there is a bias that comes into that. And, you know, that's fine, right?
Yeah, that's part of the appeal of sport.
Absolutely, of sport. Yeah, exactly. That, you know, you get attached to your team and you love it when they win and you hate it when they lose. But with this, I think this is... certainly in my top five rugby matches I've ever seen.
I think so. I think it's certainly absolutely my favourite low-scoring game.
Yeah.
And I, as I said, it's my favourite World Cup final. I think it's
I think it's the best World Cup final ever, no doubt.
Top five favourite World Cup matches.
Yeah.
Another one is In This World Cup. Another one is Fiji Namibia in the start of this World Cup.
Yeah.
That is in my top five.
I mean, I think that a lot of the reason why we chose to do the 2011 World Cup to kick off this podcast is because we reflect on it well because the final was so bloody good, you know? Yeah. That's a big part of how you reflect on a World Cup. Like, I think of the 2019 World Cup and I think of Cheslin Kolbe's sidestep.
Exactly. Yeah, it becomes such a part of it. And frankly, 2007 is maybe the worst thought of World Cup. It's the least remembered fondly.
Mm. Yeah.
Partly because it had the worst final. It had a really boring final.
Yeah.
The two most boring finals, right, are 99 and 2007. Mm-hmm. 99, admittedly, is the only one I haven't watched in full.
Yeah.
So I'm going off the highlights there.
Sure.
But it's the most comprehensive. It's the biggest winning margin in the final.
Yeah.
And it's one eventually we'll get to on this podcast. And
sure.
I quite enjoy going through that because it's the one World Cup I don't really know as much about as the others.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but that one is perhaps the least fondly remembered because you had one team who was clearly better than everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
A bit like 2015, but 2015 had, you know, the likes of Japan standing up and, you know, Wales beating England and you had lots bubbling away.
2015 was memorable for different reasons.
Yeah.
That was a very special World Cup, but for a variety of reasons.
Whereas you then have 2007, which is, as I say, a World Cup there's not a lot of nostalgia for.
Yeah.
And when the Springboks won in 2019, everyone went away and instead talked about 95 in comparison. Because there was a direct line, there was a very clean narrative between the two with, you know, Nelson Mandela to see Gracie.
Yeah.
But then you also just kind of forget that one in the middle. You know, because it wasn't a very interesting final. There was kind of the one break and then a few nice kicks. And otherwise, you kind of just got on with it. Whereas this final, man, this final, what a game of rugby.
This is what it's all about, isn't it? And I think to kind of get into it quite early, safe to say France had been mostly written off during the week.
Mm.
Not only because they were playing the All Blacks, but because there was so much internal conflict between the coaches and the players and everything. Marc Lièvremont, the French head coach, had completely lost the plot by this point. And effectively, the likes of Thierry Dusautoir, Dimitri Ashvili, Aurélien Rougerie, and sort of the senior players in that team had basically taken over. Yeah.
Yeah.
They'd effectively taken the reins and gone, well, Lièvremont can select us, but we're going to do all the coaching here. And everybody had written the France off, including probably us at the time. You know, we'd probably thought, and they were many times referred to as the worst ever Rugby World Cup finalists. And obviously the All Blacks had so much pressure heaped on them that became a really weird battle, didn't it? The team that has to win the World Cup and the team that can't win the World Cup.
Yeah, so they played previously in the tournament. New Zealand had won 37-17, 20-point margin.
Yeah,
there.
They battered him.
And it was like that scoreline flattered France. They had an interception try and then a try right at the death.
Should not have counted.
Yeah. Like they were two quite soft tries scored in the last 10 minutes, really.
Yeah.
Or last 15 minutes. So yeah, New Zealand were completely comprehensive and started to shut the game down and, you know, start trialing tactics for what if the game is already won in the second half.
Yeah.
You know, that's how comprehensive they were in the first.
Yeah.
And so
like a dress rehearsal.
This game was, as you said, written off as a one-sided result. I watched the American coverage
of
this, and the one pundit they had on at the start talking about it said that the All Blacks will not slip up tonight. They will win this. They will finally get that monkey off their back. He was very, very certain.
Okay.
And that was kind of the tone of a lot of it, you know?
Yeah.
They weren't necessarily saying it, but the tone was, this is New Zealand's to lose, and most likely they won't.
Yeah, for sure. The pressure was very much on the All Blacks, as it has been the whole World Cup. But not least in this match, not only because it's the final, but because, for example, they'd lost Dan Carter. Then they'd lost Colin Slade. And it felt like if ever there was a time where they're going to crumble, it's now. Especially to say that they put together their two best performances of the World Cup in the previous games. Argentina tested them quite a bit in the quarterfinal, but the All Blacks showed sort of the resolve to pour through that. And then Australia
shut down. Like, it's a really, really good Wallabies team, and they shut them down.
That was, honestly, like, considering the quality of their opposition, that Wallabies game was one of the best All Black performances you'll see.
Yeah, they were fantastic. The other thing that's mentioned on the American coverage is they refer to them, quote, as a team of destiny. And they said, you know, previously seen in 1995, that Springbok team was a team of destiny. You know, they felt destined to win that World Cup, and that was exactly what all those players were on the planet to do.
Yeah.
And you felt that about New Zealand, was the amount of pressure on them. And as I said, the fact they hadn't won a World Cup since 1987.
Yeah.
And we've said this many times in this podcast, the pressure on New Zealand in the later stage of this World Cup was unlike the pressure on any other team in the history of rugby union.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
No other team has felt the pressure that the All Blacks had of, we are the best team in the world and you have to win the World Cup and literally nothing else will do.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. It's unacceptable if they if they lose this final.
If they lost this by... If Francois Trandu could kick the goal in the last minute and won this, that wouldn't have been good enough.
It would be getting brought up today.
Have been, yeah, that would have been... Like, Graham Henry would have been hung by a tree.
Yeah. Should we look at the teams?
Yes, let's. So, we have an unchanged team for France. Again, they... The semi-final was the first time they named an unchanged team under Marc Lievremont in his 4 years in charge. He's then, the mad lad's gone and done it again and named another unchanged 15. So Maxime Maeder at fullback, Vincent Clerc, Alexis Pa. It's a really strong team.
That back three is great. You know, they've been on such good form, Maeder and Clerc in particular, and, Palace, you know, on the left wing.
Centre's really gelled together in Mermoz and Rougerie. The pack is excellent. You know, Pape and Nale in the second row, really bastardy.
That
front row
is
very, very good.
Yeah, Pou, Servat and Mas. And we've not even mentioned, you know, we've gone through the whole team.
The back row, is exceptional. Doucetoir, Bonnaire, Aaron Nordicki.
I think that's as good a back row as you will have seen
see
this
in
World Cup.
Any competition.
Yeah.
They have dragged them here. Dmitry Yashvili at scrum half, playing brilliantly
really
well. Yeah. And then they have another player as well.
Yeah.
And then in amongst this 14 man of excellence, they for some reason persist with Morgan Parrott at fly half.
And I mean, don't get me wrong, Morgan Parrott, excellent player. In fact, world-class player at times, but he's not a fly half. This
world-class
is about
scrum half.
I think this is what, the fifth or sixth game he's played at fly half in his senior career?
So he had played one game at fly half as an adult prior to this World Cup.
Yeah.
He then started against the All Blacks, and he started the quarterfinal and semi-final.
Okay,
so this is number
Do
five.
Do the math. Yeah. So on the bench, they have Sarzewski, Barcea, Pierre, Wedrago, Dusan, Tranduk, and Tri. One of those names stands out, but
you've moved past too quickly there, as everyone does, right? So when they went, and I went back and looked at a couple of versions of the commentary on the opening teams coming out, and no one stops and flags up the fact they have an uncapped scrum half on the bench.
And
they have a scrum half who's never played for France before on the bench.
To do a bit of a spoiler, there's a point where Stephen Donald comes on, and one of the commentators points out that he's the first person to ever make his Rugby World Cup debut in the final. But for Jean-Marc Dusan, it's not just his Rugby World Cup debut. He has never played a game for France before. He's never played international rugby before. He's played a bit for Toulouse, probably been all right. That's kind of the story.
He was 21.
21 years old. Yeah. We'll come on to how those players on the bench, including Dusan, play when they come on, when we go through the game. But should we look at the All Blacks?
Let's. So, the All Blacks team, again, they're kind of forced to make a couple of shuffles.
Yeah.
We have Aaron Cruden continues at fly half.
Yeah. The very inexperienced at the point, Aaron Cruden, of course, who was clearly not very much trusted by Graham Henry.
Talked in some detail in the episode of the semi-final about how inexperienced he was 22, was not perhaps the sharpest, didn't really kick goals at the time, had only really started that season in order to bolster his All Blacks chances.
He partnered Piero Whippu, who was the kicker. He took the kickoffs, kicks to touch, and kicks at goal.
That's the weird thing. Seeing a nine kick off is weird.
It is a bit, isn't it, sometimes? Yeah. Manonu and Conrad Smith had been on excellent form all World Cup. Nonu in particular has been tearing it up. And then that back three of Richard Kahui coming in on the left wing with Corey Jane and Israel Dagg making up the rest of the back three, who, again, all been playing very well. Israel Dagg has scored a hatful of tries throughout the pool stage and set the one up for Manonu in the semi-final.
And again, it's a very classic All Blacks pack, isn't it? Woodcock, Mialamu, Franks, Vaughan, Whitelock, Kaino, McCaw, Reed.
Yeah.
Come on.
Let's between the last two All Blacks games, Richie McCaw, on this podcast, has received three Man of the Match nominations. He has really peaked. As you say, he's playing on one and a half legs, isn't he?
Yeah, his ankle's gone. And his rib is damaged. His rib is heavily bruised or cracked or something.
And yet, playing the best rugby of his career.
close to. He's playing brilliantly well.
So the bench for the All Blacks is Andrew Hoare, Ben Franks, Ali Williams, Adam Thompson, Andy Ellis, Stephen Donald, and Sonny Bill Williams.
I suppose the biggest call being Andy Ellis over Jimmy Cowan.
Sure. But he's been playing well in the group stage, hasn't he? So it makes sense.
And Stephen Donald being, unexpected. They hadn't needed to bring him on. He'd come and sat on the bench in the semi-final. They hadn't brought him on. They had no intention of bringing him on. And I think the plan here was they weren't going to bring him on unless Cruden either got injured or had an absolute shocker. Yeah.
They were planning to play Carter for 80 minutes. If he got injured, they'd play Slade for 80 minutes. If he gets injured, they'd play Cruden for 80 minutes. And that's just the way it is. That they were not planning to use any reserve fly halves throughout this tournament in the knockout stages.
We'll see how that goes for them.
Of course, the last team to select to go through is the refereeing, the official team. So the referee is Craig Joubert from South Africa. On those touch judges, he has Nigel Owens from Wales and Alan Rowland from Ireland. I wasn't going to say it. As the TMO, they have Julio Dos Santos. I don't actually know where he's from, but they have him.
Argentina?
Yeah, I guess so. Something like that. But yeah, there's the officiating team, of course.
The TMO's a very quiet day.
There's
a video Woodrug will be uploaded 4 years later of Joubert watching back this World Cup final. They ask him about the experience of refereeing a World Cup final. And he said, ever since I was a boy, I've always dreamt of this.
Yeah, so that means he wanted to be a player, right?
He was a kid who grew up dreaming of refereeing the World Cup final. I'm so happy for him that he managed it, man. Like, considering he is the only kid who ever dreamt that, I'm glad he managed it.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I think his phrasing makes it sound like, I wanted to play for the Springboks, and then I realised I'm not good enough to play for the Springboks and make it to a World Cup final, so I'm going to be a referee, and I'm still dreaming of that final, but in a different capacity.
No, I heard that as I wanted to be a referee. Ever since I can remember, I wanted to be a referee. Like, it's not good, fellas.
So, pre-match. We can talk about that. So France had won a coin toss to determine who plays in what kit. France had won the toss and they'd been told, you can play in blue and the All Blacks can play in white if you like. And they instead flipped it and said, no, we'll play in white, you play in black, as a way of kind of thanking the All Blacks for a good World Cup and good hospitality and stuff. And it would have felt weird seeing the All Blacks run out in white for the first time in the World Cup in the actual final.
I wonder if that was actually a factor in the game.
You reckon?
I wonder if that would have got under their skin because
it would have pissed Graham Henry off. Let's be real.
McDonald said it about the 2007. Said that playing in their change kit in that grey kit actually did affect the team, and they felt uncomposed and they felt pissed off about it.
Yeah,
they couldn't play in black I've seen the All Blacks play not in black since then, maybe once.
Yeah. I think there's been a couple of occasions maybe where they've done it. But it feels like a novelty when they do. But yeah, that would have been a good bit of shithousery if they made them play in white in the actual final. But no, fair play to France. They respected the All Blacks' tradition of playing in black and said, no, you're the home team. You can play in black.
It's just, do you know what it says to me, right?
What?
It says to me that rugby's different.
It's different. It's got so many values, man. Like, it's got respect and sportsmanship and all that shit.
Like, Twitter had just started at this point, right? This is the first World Cup with Twitter.
Yeah.
Hashtag rugby values.
Yeah, man.
Right there.
Get it out there. Yeah.
Like, you just get it. You know, you don't get other sports where someone might have a beer with someone they played with for 5 years from
Absolutely.
The opposition team.
Absolutely. You
know? People don't say hello to their friends in other sports.
No, they don't. They don't. Especially when they're like really, really good mates already. They may end up happening to wear different kits. You know, oh, man. What a game. What a sport.
Well, it's just
Let's
different.
Do a podcast about this.
Let's just how different it is.
Yeah. You're so, listening to the Rugby Values podcast.
It's just weird. I was just going to be different. So the two teams come out. Again, the American coverage says, look at the sheer confidence on Richie McCaw's face. Look how confident he is. He's so confident he's going to win the World Cup with sheer, just absolute, outright confidence. There's so much confidence. And then they say, well, let's have a look at this French team. I don't see that sort of confidence in Ducatoire and France. And... No. I don't think it was confident, but I think there was certainly something on their face.
Yeah. Ducatoire looks fierce, man. In the tunnel, he's looking at the All Blacks like, oh yeah, all right, lads, I'm going to beat you up.
So should we skip the anthems and just go to the hacker response now, right?
We'll come back to the anthems. Sure. Okay. Let's do this.
So, because I've got a point leading on from that. So the All Blacks come out, do that. Actually, you know, I think it's maybe the all-time greatest rendition of God Defend New Zealand I've heard.
Hmm. Yeah.
The entire crowd really in on it. Everyone's emotional. Richie McCaw's very emotional.
Hayley Westenra's there singing it.
Yeah. You know, he spent a lot of time on her face. And fair play to her. Well done. You've got a face. The French team belt out the anthem as best they possibly can in the conditions. You know, few of them look really emotional. Apart from Alexis Palisson, who for some reason has gone completely cross-eyed. and his eyes are looking in different directions.
Nice, nice.
He looks like a frog with eyes on the side of his head.
Before you get onto the hacker response, there's a particular line of commentary. So I listened to the Australian commentary, and at one point they point out that allegedly Richie McCaw had been to see the World Cup before, but had chosen not to touch it because he felt he hadn't earned it yet. But surely you're not actually allowed to touch it until you win it. Like, we went and saw the World Cup in 2015, and we were told specifically, please do not touch the trophy.
The trophy itself, rather than we hadn't just gone to watch it. When they do the trophy tours and so on.
Yeah, and we got our picture taken next to the trophy and stuff, but we were told specifically you cannot touch the trophy. And you know why? Because you've not won the World Cup. We thought, you know what? Fair dues. We're quite a way off doing that.
I'll come back when I've done that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe a few years' time.
Absolutely. But yeah, Richie McCaw claimed he chose not to touch the trophy. It's like, well, if you did, I mean, don't get me wrong, Richie McCaw famously puts his hands on things he's not necessarily allowed to, but that sounds really
yes, that's allegations coming out right here. Rugby is different.
It is so different. But yeah, I just thought that was quite interesting that Richie McCaw had allegedly made some kind of statement about how humble he is and stuff, and it felt a bit counterproductive.
It stinks of Sam Warburton wearing that Lions jersey everywhere when he was 8, and then saying he was never going to wear another piece of Lions official apparel until he was a real one, until he'd earned it.
Yeah,
you know, from the age of 10 onwards.
Oh, rugby's so different.
But it's a very Richie McCaw story. You know, if you watch that documentary on him, there's a lot of him doing things like that, like symbolic gestures until he felt like he'd earned it.
Yeah,
and working stupidly hard until he actually broke himself, and then he continued going anyway because, you know, he had a World Cup to win.
Yeah, for sure. So, hacker response. Let's go.
So, hacker response. Yes,
hacker itself as well.
Set up to do the hacker. And there was so much more talk around the hacker at this point, you know? About 10 years ago, people were really, really in the habit of, A, asking if someone was going to do a hacker response. I think maybe because it came so soon after, it was 2 years after Wales was doing their infamous hacker response.
Standoff,
The standoff until the All Blacks back down themselves. Worth looking up on YouTube if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, that's great.
It's the good only good television. It's one of two good rugby videos on YouTube. It's that and send him off! Send the dirty get off!
Oh,
get him off the field!
One. Yeah.
They're basically the same thing.
Yeah.
It's what actually Ryan Jones was saying to the referee. So you have that. Yeah. The All Blacks go to the hacker. And yeah, there was a lot of talk about will there be a response during the week. France in the previous World Cup during the hacker had worn T-shirts instead of the kit, and then he'd taken them off during the hacker.
Mm. And there's the famous clip of Sebastian Chabal like squaring up to Ali Williams during the hacker. And so this time, New Zealand start their Kamate hacker, and France just start getting changed. So they take off their tracksuits like whilst they're setting up, and I guess it is a thing of like, oh yeah, you know, we're gonna assert our dominance by looking like we don't care, which doesn't really help because I think that just fires them up a little bit more, the All Blacks. But anyway, so they get changed, take off their tracksuits, you know, put them behind them, whatever, whilst the All Blacks are starting to do their war dance. And then they form some kind of arrowhead formation.
Yeah. With Doucetoir in the middle as the captain. Yeah. This is a potential Dick of the Day moment. Francois Trandoute goes to the wrong side.
Oh, yes, and he has to swap back over.
Yeah, he realizes there's someone in the spot he was going to and has to run over behind as they begin to advance.
How utterly confused Damien Try looks about all of this. Like, clearly, in training the whole week, he'd been thinking, like, why an arrowhead? Why is that relevant?
Yeah.
And they'd be like, no, because it's symbolic of something. And Damien Try just looks so uncomfortable with this whole thing.
I don't know if you know much about where this came from.
No, not a clue, mate. Not a clue. So I've been wondering about it for the last 10 years.
So apparently the French squad had discussed a hacker response, and they didn't really have anything. Yeah. Well, that's it. So the day beforehand, Thierry Doucetoir himself went, why don't we do this? Marc Lievermont tried to stop his team from doing it. He said that they shouldn't do it. He apparently called it too far, walking into their half. Because what they do is they form into an arrowhead formation and they walk towards the hacker.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they flatten up into one straight line. And they get to the halfway line. And is it the 10-metre line they're not allowed to cross, or is it halfway?
They're not allowed to cross halfway.
They're not allowed to cross halfway. So and they get there, and then they start encroaching from there and inching forward further and further to get closer to the All Blacks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For some reason. I still don't know how this asserts dominance.
England got fined for it in 2019.
Yeah, of course.
So Thierry Dusatoir, I'm going to read you his quote. He said, "At one stage, we were so close to them, we wanted to kiss the New Zealanders. But I told them to take it easy."
I've not heard that. I mean, Sonny Bill Williams, very good-looking man.
Yeah, you know, like, who would have been at the front? Richie McCaw?
Yeah, I guess so.
Like, you watch his documentary, there's lots of stuff about him being frustrated as a young man. You know, yeah. Like, he probably would have appreciated it.
It's not actually a gesture of asserting your dominance. It's just a gesture of goodwill. Rugby's different.
Look, what this really comes down to is Deuce Tom really, really fancied Perry Whipu.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
He just really fancied him. Yeah. And, you know...
And thought, you know, Whipu could take him up for some romantic dinners every day.
Yeah, every single day at Pizza Hut.
Multiple times a day.
Just outside the London Welsh Centre. Yeah. really what Thierry Dusatoir dreamed of.
Imagine if Dusatoir signed for London Welsh after this World Cup as a result of that.
As a romantic gesture.
Yeah.
You know, like when Beauden Barrett signed for the Blues because it was better for his wife's job.
Yeah, exactly.
It's exactly like that, you know?
That would have been great. But no, so France encroach and they keep walking forward towards the All Blacks, towards their 10-metre line. And then after the All Blacks finish, France just kind of look like, oh shit, we're quite close to them. What do we do now? Like, they're close enough that they could all hit us. And Mar Nonu points at Imran Arunoduke and gestures like, I'm going to slit your throat to him. As a way of basically just saying, like, you're dead, mate, for coming near me and trying to, like, trash talk me like this. Which is, you know, I guess, like, if you're going to try and assert your dominance over the All Blacks in that kind of a way, I guess it's what he deserved. Like, Mar Nonu to taunt you back.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bold thing to do, isn't it? It's a bold place to go, and taunt Mar Nonu.
If you're Mar Nonu, if you look like Mar Nonu, if you're as big as Mar Nonu, you would tell him, no, you're not going to fucking mess with me, mate.
However, do you know what did stop France?
What?
The International Rugby Board, who stepped in and fined them £2,500.
Oh, right. Yeah. I do recall this, actually. Yeah.
France then got fined £2,500 for crossing halfway. Yeah. Right? World Rugby would then, and they continue to this day, use it in promotion on their own social media, saying, what a great iconic moment. What a famous moment this is.
It's funny that, isn't it? And Craig Joubert said he loved it.
Yeah. Craig Joubert said he loved it. Do you know who else loved this?
Who?
Richard Cockerell.
Huh?
And I don't know why this has come up, right? But I found an article in The Independent which began by saying that... It began with a quote from Richard Cockerell, who I don't know why they were talking about this. He was told during a post-training press conference, right, that this has happened and for a reaction because they wanted his input on every story in rugby.
Okay.
And apparently he laughed so hard he almost fell off his chair and then said, it's madness, isn't it?
Fair enough. I think that's an apt description of the final.
Because he crossed the halfway line in 1997 while facing the All Blacks.
Ah.
So they asked him about it. Okay. He laughed for about a solid minute, then said, it's madness, isn't it? The haka is a great New Zealand tradition, but I don't think the French are out of order. Fair play. I thought it was great theatre. Yeah. I can try it if you want. Without turning it into a free-for-all, the opposition should be able to do whatever they want. I don't think it's an issue.
Fair enough, I guess. I mean, that's obviously the response that Richard Cockerell was going to say. Like, I didn't expect anything else. Like, you know, anything goes in Richard Cockerell's world, I suppose.
Yeah. I like also that Mark Leovermont said that Thierry Dusatoir tried to stop them walking forwards.
Really?
Both of them have blamed each other.
Fair play. I mean...
So, that's what, because the line looks out of... It doesn't move in unison.
No, it looks slightly uncomfortable, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Much like... Damien Try, I suppose. Yes. Maybe he coordinated all of this but and just wanted to blame somebody else.
The crowd really builds at that moment.
Yeah,
like, they really, really
and
get
like for
into
both
it.
Teams, you know, like the All Blacks are thinking like, oh, they dare do this, you know, let's batter them. And France are thinking, go on, lads, you walk forwards in an arrowhead formation towards those really scary men doing a war dance in front of you.
And then, my favourite moment from this response is literally the second... The final words of Capropanga are barked out.
Mm-hmm.
Thierry Dusatoir turns and walks away. He's the first one to break out before the All Blacks even finish the final gestures of it.
Yeah.
He turns and walks away. The rest of the team is still there. And he has this look on his face of, okay, so what?
Got a job
you know,
to do
of like, no, it's not even that. It's more like, why do we waste our time with that? You know, like he turns away and walks off.
Yeah.
It's like he's... You know, he's just watched like a really bad fringe play and he's walking out for the next one.
Sure.
He doesn't look like he gives a single shit.
Yeah.
And then the version I watched at least didn't have an ad break here, so they just showed the stadium for the solid minute whilst their advert's playing in number territories, and that really helps build the atmosphere.
Yeah,
because you have the crowd baying for blood.
Yeah.
You have everyone screaming and shouting. And
anticipation, isn't it?
Left to stand on halfway, having not kicked off. And the whole thing really begins to boil even more than it would if they just kicked off immediately after that.
Yeah,
I think it's better, and the atmosphere is better for that ad break.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. The crowd is so loud that you reach that point where you wonder, like, are they going to be able to hear the referee, you know?
Yeah.
Especially when the camera then goes on to Craig Joubert, and he looks a little bit intimidated, but... You would in a crowd like that.
Hey, he's been dreaming of this since he was a boy.
He has.
Yeah, and then like, there's a few moments where the hooker can't hear the line-out call and has to come over and ask for clarity. Like, Szczerzewski at one point in the second half has to properly walk into the line-out.
Yes, I love that.
He
stood in the middle of the
on.
Tunnel, isn't he? Yeah. Yeah. No, the crowd is on top form here. And like it swings from chants of All Blacks to Allé Les Bleus. Because presumably everyone
noise.
Who isn't an All Black supporter was supporting France in this game, because we all love an underdog, don't we? So
yeah.
I think there was a stronger contingent of French fans as this game went on.
Yeah, I mean, it just becomes the sheer noise and sheer sound.
Yeah.
And then we kick off, and I'm really glad France won the toss and chose to kick off, because watching a scrum half kick off the World Cup final would have been weird.
Well... Yeah, so...
I mean, what happened anyway, because it's Morgan Parra, but...
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, within a minute of kickoff, Yashvili kicks a ball out on the full, and you kind of think, oh, this is going to be ominous, isn't it?
Yeah. So it begins with box kicking, like, in the middle of the field back and forth.
Yeah.
When teams did that, rather than box kicking on the tram lines?
Yeah, yeah, it is weird, isn't it, seeing
Yeah, pre-Joe Schmidt.
Yeah. But that first line-out is overthrown and Julien Benet steals it. And there was just tints of, because like, that happened a couple of times the previous week for France against Wales.
Mm.
And that's where Benet really stood up. And you start to think, okay, the French back row are really, really going to get a grip on this. And they manage to work the ball wide. And Vincent Clerc makes kind of a half break within a couple of minutes of kickoff. And you're thinking, like, okay, France are here to play.
Yeah, I mean...
It's a good statement.
So Grant Nisbet makes the point on commentary a few times of France haven't done much of the ball in this World Cup, but they've really come to play this time.
Yeah.
They're really using the ball well, and he keeps saying that over and over again, but there's a reason for it. And I also think it's a bit harsh on France, because they played some really attacking rugby in the up to the quarterfinal in the pool stage.
Sure.
And other than Tonga, you know. But
granted, most of it was in the last 10 minutes of games. So maybe Grant Nisbet was, you know, leaving early to avoid traffic.
Yeah,
yeah,
he had to go and have a wee, you know. Yeah, exactly. He's getting on in years at this point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so things begin to boil. There's one ruck right after the Bonaire half break, after the overthrow, where only Richie McCaw enters from the All Blacks and six French players enter to try and blast him out the ruck.
Yeah. And Richie McCaw manages to slow that ball down by a good 15 seconds.
Yep. He slows that ball down and takes almost half of the French team out of the attack.
I have no idea how legal it is, but let's ignore it.
Oh, obviously it's not legal. Yeah. It's Richie McCaw.
Yeah, exactly. And Richie McCaw gets away with a lot in this game.
Yeah.
But he's literally the best in the world at doing that.
Julien Bonnet sees that and goes, hold my beer.
Yeah, I'm not going to claim that France's rucking in this game was squeaky clean. There was quite a few questionable turnovers from both teams. Namely, Richie McCaw. Like, he gets a lot of turnovers that just are not legit at all.
So,
but that's fine, because he got away with it. And if you get away with it, it's legal.
So one point in the first 10 minutes, Bonaire makes a tackle, then lies on the Kiwi side of what would be the ruck, but only Kiwi players enter. And so that means the ball is not... out, you know, it means there is no ruck, there's no tackle line, offside line formed, and so the ball begins to spill out. Bonnet just picked it up and throws it back from what looks like an offside position. He's the tackler lying in the way of the scrum half.
Yeah, he effectively does like a dive pass, doesn't he?
Yeah, like back onto his own side.
Yeah,
right. And what is it's the same thing Italy did against England in 2016, infamously.
Yeah.
It's he knew no tackle line was formed. Exactly.
Yeah.
The Fox. Bonaire does that, but he just lies in an offside position and reclaims the ball. It's brilliant. I love it.
Yeah.
One of those things
no
looks
part
so
of it looks
illegal.
Legal. Yeah.
It looks so illegal that you know it has to be legal, because there's no other way a seven of Bonaire's quality
would
do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's... like peak Julien Bonaire. He knows the laws so inside out, he knows that wasn't legally, technically a ruck.
Yeah.
And he therefore can just walk up and steal the ball.
Yeah. Yeah. And like Bonaire gets away with a lot of stuff like that throughout the game, as does Deux Étoiles, to be fair.
Yeah.
There's another one where like Rougerie basically just seals off an All Blacks ruck and then pops the ball up and somehow gets away with it, like inside France's own 22. And I don't know if it's just a thing of just like, this referee is human. He's probably not going to give this between the posts in a World Cup final because that's going to be a massive call. And this is really, really obvious. Like, why would a player of my calibre do this in a World Cup final? I wouldn't unless I knew it was legal.
There's a thing Joubert says in that little bit of him watching back over the game. Have I felt confident that that call was clear and obvious enough with 15 minutes to go?
Sure.
Would suggest to me that he let a lot of things go, especially in the second half, where he knew they would be contentious.
That's right, because in that video he said that there's a point where he evaluated like how clear and obvious things have to be in the last 20 minutes when there was one point in the game, which kind of implies that he wasn't already doing that.
Yeah, but I really like the way Joubert referees this game. I know there are people that complained about it, but this game is so open.
Yeah, that's it, that's it. Like, say what you want about mistakes that were made, and believe me, there were a few of them, you know. But also, on the flip side, if you look at any refereeing game, you know, there will always be mistakes, you know. And people have analysed Craig Joubert's performance in this final. People have accused him of match-fixing and everything.
Which is ridiculous.
But, like, there's a video on YouTube of, I think it was some Kiwi TV channel who did an analysis of this. And don't get me wrong, it was comprehensive and very convincing.
Yeah.
The sort of mistakes that they pointed out that Joubert made. There's a video on YouTube called The Anatomy of a Final where somebody goes into, you know, a 25 minute deep dive on all of this. Look, if you're the sort of person who is into talking about refereeing decisions in sport and that's not a bad thing, then I would recommend those. I personally am not on this particular occasion.
See, okay, what
as we're doing
just,
this podcast.
What I absolutely just hate is 25 minute breakdowns of one rugby match on YouTube.
Sure, yeah.
Just the only a wank would ever make them or watch them.
Yeah. But yeah, no. If you're interested in that,
lovely people would watch them.
Yeah,
but you know, no one would ever make them.
But no, if you're interested in that, then I recommend going for it because it is very in depth and it is actually quite interesting.
So,
but let's go with the reading that Joubert does referee this. It's a really good game,
Joubert,
and a lot of that comes down to the referee.
Joubert blows for things very, very quickly.
Yeah,
or he doesn't blow for them at all.
Yeah,
you know, there's very little waiting, making his mind up and blowing the decision.
Absolutely.
You look at, I think every single scrum, there's no scrum resets in this game.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's only one scrum in the first half an hour. The second scrum of the game is on 31 minutes, and that's France's first put in.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's a single scrum reset, certainly off the top of my head, because he either blows for a penalty right away if something goes down, or a free kick, or he just lets the ball play on.
Sure.
And I like that.
Yeah, I like that.
Because the thing that really stood out to me watching this back today, now, you know, is how high the ball in play time is.
Yeah, yeah.
The ball in play time must be the highest of this entire World Cup. And it must be, even by, you know, the ball in play time always gets higher and higher and higher.
Yeah.
It's got higher every single World Cup on average. And it's got actually, the last three World Cups, it's increased by smaller increments.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if it really slows down as we go on.
Mm.
But the ball, this must have been the highest ball in play time of this World Cup, and I think it's higher than we would get in most games nowadays.
And the best thing about a high ball in play time is that both teams get knackered, and it means that the intensity has to be through the roof. And this is, as I say, it's probably the highest intensity test match I've ever seen, this final. It's absolutely insane when it gets to the second half, and the amount that the two teams have to battle. And like, again, like, the amount of silly decisions that teams might or might not make is probably the mark of it when they're under the cosh, you know?
Mm. There's a ruck France have 40 metres out from the line that I remember thinking to myself, this is just as tense as most 5-metre rucks in other games are. Because, and this is the thing I've talked about in the past that I absolutely love about this game, is that every single moment feels relevant. It feels like the game could burst and break.
Sure.
You know, like there are times in which France is just popping it to Pape to set up a ruck, and you feel like this could decide the game.
Yeah.
Right? Anytime they make two passes in a row, you start to think, is Vincent Clerc going to, you know, make a little break like he almost did in the first minute?
Yeah.
Are we going to find some space for Rougerie?
Absolutely.
What's going to happen? Any moment feels like it could break. And it is, as I said, the ball in play time was so high. Most games this tight and this tense, as we saw in perhaps the Wales South Africa game in 2019. Which I think is one of the other contenders for the most intense games I've ever seen.
Agreed.
And the most balanced and level. Most games like that are dominated by kicking. Yeah. And this game was an incredibly tense and tight game with one point in it where both teams were running the ball.
Yeah.
And most of the ball stayed in hand and most of the ball stayed going through the hands and through the phases.
You still get, like, even though this is one of the tightest games you'll ever see, you still get the odd speculative offload and people going for really bold plays. Like, there's a point where Pascal Pape goes through a bit of a gap and then he tries this really speculative offload. There's about 30% chance of going to hand. Monono intercepts it and boots it downfield. France are back in their own 22. And that's a proper sliding doors moment, isn't it? That, like, you know, the difference between the All Blacks defending on their own 10-metre line and then defending in the French 22. It's such a massive turning
point. There's a superb one in the second half where France throw about five offloads in a row. And then one of them gets into Yashvili's hands, who just like dinks it behind down the line and into the corner and forces Dag to slice a kick.
Yeah.
And it's very like, no, this is a World Cup final. We've had enough of this now. Everyone shut up and put your dummies back in
your mouth. No Jouet, only tactics.
Yeah. We do not have Jouet now. Not in this house. Not under Yashvili's rules.
Also, after Marnonu does that kick into the French 22, it's a brilliant kick over the French line. Kick. Phil Kearns on the Australian commentary says, that's the first time I've ever seen Marnonu kick a footy. And it's like, mate, yeah, he's one of the best kicking centres in the world.
Grant Nisbet says that's a rare kick by Marnonu.
Like,
and I know he'd only just added the kicking game in the year leading into this World Cup. But if you've been watching this World Cup, he's kicking a lot, you know?
Yeah,
and he obviously said, by 2015, he's developed the point at which he's one of the best kicking centres you'll ever see.
Yeah, absolutely. Like,
I mean, by 2015, he's the most well-rounded and best centre you'll ever see.
For sure. But no, it wasn't a rarity.
At this point, no. Like, if you've been watching this whole World Cup, him putting in a great, great, really accurate touch finder that pins France on their own 22 is commonplace. That keeps happening.
For sure.
Incidentally, right? How come every single kick in this World Cup feels like it's from Dan Parker's highlights reel? Like, every game on this, it's like watching Ronald Agar in his prime in a supercut every time someone kicks the ball.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of this, you know, in this final, we've got Yashvili and Parra, who are like two of the best kicking scrum halves, granted one of them's not playing scrum half, in the world. Mm. And then, you know, I mean, the thing is, Cruden's not really trusted to kick that much, is he?
No.
They've kind of left it to Whipu, Nonu and Dag. All of the kicking duties.
Mm.
But I think that they, on the whole, do a good job. Dag has a couple of stinkers. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, I mean, Dag has two in very quick succession.
One in particular where he goes for touch from a penalty and he misses by about 15 yards and it just bounces into Palace's hands.
Far side.
Yeah.
He does, it's instead a really of going weird for the choice, sides near him, he goes.
I don't know if
he
had the wind,
side,
maybe?
Goes to try and bounce, like, it looks like he's trying to bounce the ball further.
Yeah, like a trick
shot.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's the wind or just his footedness. Yeah. And it just lands in Palace's hands. It's terrible.
Very
then
strange.
Then moments later, he goes for an up and under and just scoops it straight up in the air.
Yeah, that's, very strange. But, so Cruden's not really trusted. But no, anyway, so I mentioned Parra a minute ago. There's a point where he has to tackle Marnonu. And Richie McCaw accidentally knees him in the head as he's going to ruck over. And it is an accident.
Yeah.
The Australian commentators were obviously saying, oh, that's deliberate, he should be sent off. That's similar, exactly
send
the same
him
as Quade Cooper.
Get him off the field!
They're saying it's exactly the same as when Quade Cooper kneed Richie McCaw in the head, which was just very deliberate and should have been a red card. Richie McCaw's was accidental and unfortunate. But anyway, Parra has to go off for, not an HIA, I think they pretended it was a blood sub for François Trandouk.
It's worth saying, right before Parra takes that knee to the head, he also takes two high tackles in a row.
Yes.
Like, one guy tries to high tackle him, misses him. And I think it's Nonu then goes in and high tackles him instead.
They definitely target him.
Thorn and Nonu. I can't remember which way around they are. They hit them.
Yeah.
And then he takes a knee to the head.
Yeah. He's very, very
to be a fly half,
then
he took an arrow to the head. Which is 2011. That was relevant.
That's a good meme in 2011.
That's a 2011 meme.
Yeah.
That's 11 minutes in. They're 2011 minutes in.
Nice.
But I then have written down immediately after that, how are we only 13 minutes in?
Yeah, so much happens, man. Like,
I know.
This game is packed with just rugby. Like, it's great.
There's so much of it.
So the All Blacks get a penalty off this, probably about 15 metres inside their own half. And somehow Piriwipu pumps the ball all the way down into the French 22 from the penalty.
Yeah.
It is an insane touch finder.
It's brilliant. Very,
and like,
very
I good. Yeah. Piriwipu had a pretty mixed bag of a game, I think it's safe to say.
Yes.
But that kick was properly like one of the most important points of this entire match, right?
Mm. Yeah, no, it's a huge, because so Doucetoire turns them over. They then, the All Blacks then win a penalty back after, that's a huge turnover. And bam, no, smash down somehow into the 22.
Welcome to your own 22, mate.
And so that, I think the key thing here is it's so fast, right? There's almost no time between Ripu taking the ball to kick it and the ball being thrown into the lineout.
Yeah.
Like, they get down into that half and set the lineout and throw
travel
it
very
in
fast.
Pretty much
yeah.
record time.
Yeah. So the All Blacks lift two pods at this lineout. Mm. They start with, basically, they've got three pods set. One of them at the front, you've got Tony Woodcock pretending he's going to lift up, like, Brad Thorne or somebody. They lift Whitelock in the middle and then McCaw at the back. And Woodcock wraps around, does he not?
He does, indeed. And this opens up a huge gap right in the middle between the two pods. They drop the ball straight back down, and France were just watching for the line-out, just trying to set for a drive, knowing what they're expecting, especially because they'd gone for that a few times in the knockout games.
Yeah.
So they didn't do a lot in the pool stage, but during knockout games, the All Blacks really looked to more, and they really looked to add that into their game. And I wonder if part of that was as
like a bluff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was a bluff. So the team's expecting
I think it
more
was.
And more
I think
in
it
the
was.
Knockouts. Yeah. So they then had this move built up. And I don't know which one came first, you know?
Sure.
But I think that's definitely a consideration. They started, they didn't maul in the pool stage. They started mauling later on.
Yeah.
And then from there, boom.
This French pack would have wanted to maul against the All Blacks. This
oh,
is
yeah,
such a
yeah.
massive French pack that they'll have
William
they'll have
Servat, man.
Yeah.
Servat's dream is right? to maul against the All Blacks.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
what he dreamed. Still at night, he's retired. His body is in bits. He has just won the European Cup as a coach. He still, every night, wakes up at 3 a.m. wishing he was mauling against the All Blacks.
Absolutely. So the ball goes to the back where Richard McCaw catches it.
Mm-hmm.
And Woodcock has run into this hole in the middle of the line-out. McCaw pops it down to Woodcock, who goes straight through and scores the first try of the final and slides in slightly awkwardly, because it's that thing when a prop not only scores, but scores in the literal World Cup final. And it's like, I need to not botch this. I need to just dive now. I don't care about taking this close to the post or anything. I need to secure these 5 points, because points are such a rich currency in a final.
I believe I'm right in saying it's the first time since 1987 that the first points in a World Cup final were from a try.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
I believe I'm right in saying that.
Right. I mean,
that's
yeah, so tries aren't necessarily rare in World Cup finals, but obviously you've got to really graft for them, haven't you? So
I think they kind of are at this point, though.
Mm. I mean, the previous one was tryless. The 2007.
Previous one was tryless. One before that, one try apiece.
Yeah.
One before that was the one blowout we've had in the World Cup final.
Yeah.
Before that, tryless. Before that, one try apiece. Or two tries to one. Yeah. One try apiece. And then before that was the highest scoring World Cup final, which was three tries to one.
Yeah.
In 87.
Yeah, that's before defence existed. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But yeah, so being Tony Woodcock, scoring the opening try of the World Cup final... the opening points of the World Cup final must have.
I'm wrong. So it is the first time a World Cup final, the first right. points of the World Cup final was a try. Sorry,
okay.
No, there was a drop goal by Grant Fox in the first half.
Okay, interesting.
In the first World Cup.
And scored by a loose head prop as well. So
yeah,
how could that be
first,
any better?
Only prop to score in a World Cup final.
Yeah, fair play. But yeah, no, it was a really, really well crafted move by the All Blacks. They'd evidently done their research to know that gap was definitely going to open up. Yeah, it was a great move and very worthy of 5 points, which was only five because Piruipu missed the kick horribly. He'd also missed one much harder penalty before this, really
badly.
Yeah,
but he misses it really bad. And the crowd sort of go, oh!
Like, they realise it's concern. It's not just like an unlucky thing. They realise
yeah,
it's concerning
that,
in the World Cup final.
We skipped over that. That's a big moment, frankly.
Yeah, it is.
You feel, if he'd got that, I think the All Blacks win this game in a very different fashion.
Yeah.
Him missing that, the whole crowd don't turn on him, but you can just feel
there's
the
no
World
concern,
Cup flashes before their eyes.
Yeah.
They kind of, because he misses it so badly, you can tell there's nerve settling in, you know,
yeah,
in this All Blacks
sure.
team. That generally, I think, actually in the first half, they don't look nervous.
No.
They don't look in the panicky sense people seem to remember from them, because everyone was nervous and because the game was closer than we were expecting.
Yeah.
This game looks like actually they're just being matched by France
yeah.
rather than the All Blacks are necessarily crumbling.
Yeah.
And it was actually a stark watching it back of how... When I say how well the All Blacks are playing, I don't mean in the way they did against Australia or the way they did against Argentina.
Yeah.
Where they had the two best performances of the tournament. But they are playing well. You know,
yes.
like they are absolutely putting in as solid a performance as you can against a
yeah.
France team who are playing out their skin.
Yeah, absolutely. And like straight from the kickoff, the All Blacks are on the attack again. And like they managed to work the ball wide to Dag, and straight away you're thinking, oh my God, they're going to score again.
Yeah.
Granted, there's a reason why they don't. And do you know what that reason is?
Is it Thierry Dusautoir?
Thierry Dusautoir exists, is the reason
he
why.
He does, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I noticed this.
He most certainly exists. Like, if you watch back this game, you'll probably notice by the 80th minute that Thierry Dusautoir exists.
It's amazing, because even Grant Nisbet noticed that.
That says a lot. There's a great point where... So, Thierry Dusautoir single-handedly stops this all-back attack. Like, he covers about three men and turns the ball over and wins a penalty. There's a great point where... I don't think it's on this one. I think it's one slightly later on, where Richie McCaw is penalised for holding on because Thierry Dusautoir jackals him. And he gives him a look of like, no, you're not allowed to do that. There's a look of pure disrespect coming from
he
McCaw.
He looks baffled, then angry.
Yeah. It's a
hell of an emotional segue.
It's a look
segue.
Of pure disrespect of just like, I've heard of you. I think I might remember you from last time. Don't you dare do this again. And like it is pure disrespect, but in the best way possible.
It's the one Richie McCaw, every time he's asked about oppositions he respects, Dusautoir is the one guy that comes up. You know? He always regards them as the best player he ever played against.
Isn't it a thing
against.
That basically he doesn't really remember any players from Northern Hemisphere other than Dusautoir?
He basically doesn't care about like he remembers who David Pocock is.
Yeah.
He probably remembers George Smith. But every time you see him talk about opposition players or other players or just players in general, you know, they ask him about someone other than Dan Carter, his old like BFF. He always brings up Thierry Dusautoir. He regarded Dusautoir, yes. He regarded Dusautoir as the best player he ever played against. And again, like he played against Mike Ruingi.
I hope so. He probably did.
He played against Johan Dazel.
Yeah,
what a player, Johan Dazel.
Absolutely.
Johan Dazel scored one try against him, whereas Dusautoir scored two, so he's officially only half 50% as good.
50% as good and as Dusautoir, yeah.
Better than every other player who never scored a try against the All Blacks when they were playing them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Conor Traynor scored two tries against the All Blacks.
Conor Traynor's as good as Thierry Dusautoir.
Yeah, but he's the only player who is, obviously.
But he wasn't playing in that game. Against Richie McCaw.
No, that's true.
Need to talk about him.
That's very true. So, also, like, Dusautoir didn't score one try in a college game after the World Cup final, did he?
That we know of.
Yeah, there was no Jerry Collins Barnstable gambit going on this time round.
Can we look up, like, Toulouse University?
Yeah.
And see if they just had
London Welsh?
Yeah, London Welsh.
He came in the championship for London Welsh.
With his crush to try and impress him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, there's a moment in the first half where they cut to a guy in the crowd who's got massive thick glasses on and a moustache, right? Mm-hmm. And I kept looking at him and going, like, other than the massive glasses and the moustache, he's wearing it like a proper All Blacks jersey, like that season's All Blacks jersey with the World Cup logo on it and everything. I kept looking at him and thinking, he looks so much like Dan Carter. Like, I just thought, like, has Dan Carter used the fake glasses and nose gambit to try and sneak back into the final? And he's just hoping that if Stephen Donner goes uninjured, they have to call on someone in the crowd.
We accused Yashvili of that last time, so maybe he's mocking him.
Exactly. I wonder if it's that. But I imagine it's just like he's trying to go, he's brought his boots into his ear.
Yeah.
He's going to run on and it's like, hi, I'm Can Darter.
Yeah.
I'm Ruddy's brother.
I play fly half. Yes.
I can play fly half. When Stephen Donner goes uninjured and they turn to the crowd and shrug.
It's good that you brought up Ruddy Darter, who is the epitome of like, all right, mate, go out and do it yourself then, if you think you're so good. If you can criticise all these top tier players, you know. So, yeah, I think it's fitting that you bring him up in and his brother is actually trying to do that.
Yes.
You know, like that,
that industry together.
That French prankster guy who's like, appeared on the Montpellier pitch. And like played a phase at scrum half for them or something. It was just some imposter. Yeah, maybe it's like that guy.
Yeah. I hope it is that guy. Can we? You know when that guy ran around a supermarket at Sonic the Hedgehog?
Yeah, and played Mario Kart in the streets. Oh, yeah, what a guy!
Let's get him in the French team.
Yeah, Remy Gaillard. That's his name.
Remy Gaillard. There we are.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, he was not playing for France in this match.
That we know of.
That we know of, yes.
He could have been Alexis Palisson.
That's very true.
That could be why Palisson pretty much dropped off a cliff a season later, because he had to go back to pranking.
Maybe. He's got something to do with the reason why Fufu Wadrago didn't get on.
Maybe he was Fufu Wadrago.
Yeah, maybe he kidnapped him, and then they realised in the warm-up, like, oh, this new bootleg Wadrago is not playing very well.
I mean, for all we're praising him, he is a man I've seen do blackface before. So,
oh, of course,
him doing a Drago does make you think.
Oh yeah, okay, let's drop this.
Let's drop this like he would drop the ball.
Yes. So not long after this, France are just constantly penalised. There's a point where Maxime Mermoz caught off his feet, and Whipu thinks, you know what, lads, gonna go for goal again. Get us 8-0 up. Except he again misses horribly.
He doesn't get the mate.
He's a good 10, 15, maybe even 20 metres away from the right hand post on this point. And there's not quite between the posts, but it's so gettable.
There's a moment in the lead up to that where Marnoni throws a dummy and straightens up that made me properly like, thinking he's going to go through.
Yeah.
Again, it's a game where you feel like things could open up at any point and someone could make a break, but it's so tight. And so Nonu having that bit of space as he straightens up and him being Mar bloody Nonu and able to potentially batter through. It's just such an exciting moment. You can't help but, even though, you know, I've watched the game multiple times and it was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I know who wins and I know the score. I know, you know, how every point comes about.
Yeah.
I couldn't help but get caught up in so many small moments like that. Yeah.
There's moments that really, really excite you. There's a point I completely forgot about where Richard Kahui nutmegs Maxime Médard.
Really?
Yeah.
I missed that.
He goes for like a grubber kick towards the try line for Richie McCaw to chase.
Yeah.
Oh, Rougerou grounds it. And yeah, he nutmegged Maxime Médard in the process, which is a fun thing to do in a World Cup final. You know, it's one of the bucket list, isn't it? I won a World Cup and I nutmegged their fullback in the process.
That's pretty impressive. That's pretty impressive. Right before that, right, there's a rock that it looks like Dusseldorf could have turned over and he steps off and leaves it. And I'm really curious as to what happened there.
Yeah. What he was thinking. What would have happened if he didn't step away from it?
Yeah, but it looks like he consciously looks at it and thinks, no, I'm not going to turn that over.
Yeah.
When I was looking at it thinking, Thierry, you're going to turn that over. Go for it.
Like, he's turned over about 90% of the All Blacks' regular ball at this point already. So, you know, I fancy his chances. Also, here's a fun stat. Thierry Dusautoir made over 1/5 of France's tackles in this game.
It's about right.
Yeah, that's a genuine stat.
By his standards, again, I believe you. By his standards against the All Blacks, that's pretty low.
Yeah, very true. He's aiming for 50%. But
he only made 14 tackles. And, like, he missed one in this game as well.
He made more than 14 tackles.
I have it down as 14.
I have it down as 23.
Wow, okay.
It came up on the official graphic with, like, 5 minutes to go that he'd made 21.
Right. Okay.
And then he made two more after that, by my count. So, yeah, either way, he was very good.
Yes,
he made a lot of tackles and a lot of turnovers, and he ran very well and rucked well and everything.
In 2007, he made 38 tackles, didn't miss one. This time, he did miss one.
Oh.
And therefore,
Dick of the day material, that is.
I think that he should be shot.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. That's the official stance of the Squid Rugby World Cup retrospective on Thierry Dusautoir.
The Guardian gave him 9.5 in their
what the hell else was he meant to do?
But that's it. They've never given a 10 before.
Oh, okay.
And they said, has there ever been a better performance by a player on the losing side in any game? His hits could be heard from the noise above the crowd as he outfought McCaw. There is no higher tribute.
He would have got the extra 0.5 if not for the one bullet of sweat that went down his face on the 78th minute.
That's it, he sweats in this game.
Yeah.
He sweats in this game. They cut to him a few times and he's sweating.
Yeah.
And you go,
which is a rare sight.
Oh, they've
France
done it.
Are crumbling.
This is a, like, you know how tough this game is when Dusautoir is sweating in the second half after having made 50 tackles.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, Dusautoir is obviously everywhere.
Yeah.
There's a point where he gets a turnover and finds... Francois Chandouk does a brilliant kick into the All Black 22.
Yes.
Corey Jane fields it and his foot crosses the line, the touchline, that is, and Nigel Owens calls it. All of the All Blacks fans are fuming. They see it in slow-mo on the big screen and see that his foot's in touch, but they continue to boo.
No, because so he tiptoes along the touchline and he doesn't go over the touchline the first two times.
Yeah.
And then right before they cut away, he does.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of them made their mind up, started booing. Then saw evidence of the contrary and went, I've started now.
Yeah, we've got to commit now, haven't we?
Yeah. I'm already booing. You know, we're already well into the ooh.
Yeah.
We haven't even got to the urns. We haven't even cheered for Lloyd Burns.
Oh, man. If only he played in this final. It's amazing that actually could have happened.
We could have had a World Cup final.
Like, so many people argue that Wales should have made that final. So therefore, so many people argue that Lloyd Burns should have played in the World Cup final.
We were Lee Halfpenny hitting one kick, like a fraction of a bit of force and power better. You know, like a little bit higher on the little red bar on a rugby game, away from Lloyd Burns playing in a World Cup final, then going back to being a bricklayer a year later.
It's amazing that on the Rugby World Cup final episode of this podcast, we've mentioned Lloyd Burns.
We are going to talk about Lloyd Burns for a further 3 minutes.
Okay.
Lloyd Burns was a bricklayer 18 months ago.
Let's cut this short from 3 minutes to 3 seconds.
There we are, done. Okay.
So France have a line out in the All Blacks 22, but they knock it on.
That's the first time France get into the All Blacks 22 in the entire game.
Wow, okay.
That's the first time they get into the 22. Right. It's about 23 minutes in.
So not long after this, Aaron Cruden has a bit of a run at the line, and he goes down injured. His hyperextends his knee. It's
goes from under
awful
him.
To it's... look at. For some reason, they keep re-showing it.
Okay.
And it looks horrible. Like, I don't know why anyone wants to see that twice, but there's a point where... So Stephen Donald, who had been previously called up from white baiting in the Waikato River, he warms up to come onto the pitch. And Aaron Cruden basically stands up and goes, yeah, man, I'm going to play on. Even though he was in agony. And then he goes, yeah, I'll play on. And then literally he begins to like ever so slightly swivel his hips and realizes his knee is absolutely like fucked. Yeah. And then he just goes down and says, ah! And he's in agony again.
There is only really one time that we see Spider-Cam in this game. Mm. There's two, actually. There's a replay of the second try, which we'll get to.
Yeah.
And then for Cruden's injury. And they have the camera positioned directly above him. So you can see both the doctors working on his knee and his face as it's happening. And poor guy hurts.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You can feel it on his face. And you can see that his knee is not where it should be. It's on his elbow. And doctors say that knee should be in the little middle bit of your leg.
Yeah, yeah.
I spoke to a doctor. That was exactly what he said. Thank you. P Money was the doctor.
Yes.
So what he's doing now, his rap career's gone down the drain. You know, he's done what his parents wanted to do, and he's become a doctor.
He tried doing the Aaron Cruden friendly track, but
yeah. It didn't really go very well.
No. It's because he mentioned Beaver and Piruipu in it, and just, you know.
Now he gives out great advice such as knees be knees, bro.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey. You got one of those elbows? Sick ass, bro.
Thank you, P-Money, for coming back on the podcast.
Oh, no worries, bro.
And your voice breaking midway through. I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's good to be back, man. Do you want to hear my new song?
Yeah, man, please.
It's called All Black Some Things.
Okay, go on.
I'm just going to give you a wee little... I'm Scottish now. I'm just going to give you a very, very little...
Are you Sean Maitland?
I'm gonna give you a very little burst of it, bro. But sorry, thank you for ruining my punchline. It's gonna be a tribute to John Hardy and Sean Maitland, and the All Black somethings careers.
I hope Grayson
congratulations
Hart makes
to Grayson Hart, the inventor of Marxism, of course. Mm-hmm. Cheers, bro. We'll
John
see
Hardy,
you next
the inventor
time.
Of cocaine.
Is that a fact?
Yeah, yeah. Lawrence Dallaglio loves him.
Wait a minute. He's Amy Cocaine, England Women's Hockey's
dad.
Can he play 10 as well?
Sure.
Okay, right.
Anyway, fuck off, P Money.
Cheers, bro. Knees be knees, bro. Peace and love.
You Ringo Starr now.
He is Ringo Starr. He is Dr. Ringo Starr, P Money.
Instead of PhD, it's P Money.
Yeah.
That was a really bad joke. Anyway, Stephen Donald comes on in the World Cup final.
Stephen Donald comes on.
His first Rugby World Cup match.
There's some booze in the crowd.
I know, I love that. It's so hostile. And like, they absolutely hate
what do you want?
Like,
what do you want? He's your fourth fly half. This is his 23rd cap. What could you possibly want more than this?
Yeah. So in the previous episodes, we sort of floated the question of who would have been the next sort of reserve fly half for New Zealand.
Yes.
And somebody got in touch and said, basically, it was Mike Delaney, Stephen Brett, and Matt Berquist were kind of like the four ITM Cup players at the time.
Yeah. I was sent a couple, one in a Twitter thread, and unfortunately I haven't been able to find that looking back. Another from at Paranoid Adnoid, solid joke, shocked and appalled on Twitter, who sent me a list of the likely fly halves who could have replaced Stephen Donald had he gone down injured. So Stephen Brett, capped by New Zealand in the 20s and the Maori All Blacks, never an All Black but not far off. Luke McAllister, who had just signed for a French club so ineligible, but he wasn't joining them until after the World Cup.
Okay, similar to Stephen Donald then, because he'd just signed for
Bath. So they could have brought him in, possibly, but he was ineligible. Lockie Monroe, he just writes, haha, no. Mike Delaney, who obviously got the one All Black cap in 2009, who was probably next in line, I reckon, having had a few looks over this. We have Daniel Kirkpatrick, who had played New Zealand under-19s and under-20s, and he's the poor puts. I remember him being promising, but sort of disappeared. Matt Berquist.
Of Treviso fame.
So, who then went on to play most of his career at Treviso. Yep. And then Tyler Blaindall, who was in the Crusader squad, but said didn't take the field, so no chance. New Zealand under-20s the previous year, though. Tyler Blaindall obviously went on to play most of his career at Munster, tried to qualify for Ireland, is now coaching Munster. Oh, no, he's gone back to coach Crusaders, hasn't he? He's gone back to coach New Zealand. The other contenders they've got are Robbie Robinson, who obviously spent most of his time as a fullback, but could have possibly played there. Lima Sopwanga, who was playing his first season of pro rugby, age 20.
Wow.
And then you also had Gareth Anscombe, who was the under-20s fly half that year, had played, but hadn't played Super Rugby up until that point. So yeah, sent me a full list of players who played Super Rugby at fly half that season and were not
Thank
getting
injured.
So they did have some options, but they weren't particularly expansive.
Sure.
And Mike Delaney and his one cap against Italy was probably going to be the next line.
Yeah, hell of a drop from Dan Carter, safe to say.
Yes.
It's a long way down. But Stephen Donald is on, and to be fair, he gets stuck in when he comes on. You know, he makes like two or three tackles in a row and sort of goes, look, I know that there are question marks over me, but like, don't test me defensively because I'm going to do fine. Obviously, he's a big unit, Stephen Donald, for a fly half. So defensively, he's actually pretty good. Obviously, he does have a mixed bag when he comes on. There's a couple of things he does that are mistakes. But, but you know, defensively, I don't think he's an issue for the All Blacks.
No, absolutely not defensively. I think he's certainly more so than Cruden as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Who was not particularly big at this point. You know, he filled out a bit as he went
on. Yeah, but yeah. But Francois Chandruc misses a drop goal just after this, and it's actually very well struck.
They set for it really nicely.
Yeah.
So he drops into the pocket. France play one more phase, then go back to him. Periwipu only notices they're setting for the drop goal and starts calling for everyone to watch him, like, right as he's going for it.
Right.
And it had been very obviously dropped into the pocket the phase beforehand.
Yeah, sure.
But alas, yeah, he strikes it really well. Doesn't quite get it cleanly enough. It goes just wide. It does look like it's going over.
Yeah,
which is something
it's a really good strike, isn't it? Yeah, and you know that.
And really good option. Really good option.
Could have been a turning point for
Montoya.
You know,
30 odd minutes on the clock. Currently 5-0.
Yeah, and after that comes one of my favourite moments of this match, which we regularly reference, which is after the 22 dropout, and you didn't clear it to Tranduk again, who's covering at fullback. And he completely burns Richard Kahu for pace on the outside, which is iconic in itself. And then he throws the most glorious dummy you'll ever see and steps
it's
Jerome
Kamer.
It is unreal. It's maybe the best dummy of the World Cup.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
And steps inside Jerome Kano. And Jerome Kano, like, very solid defender, very quick man, very difficult to get around. And Tranduk makes a good sort of 40 yards on this run and gets just up to the All Black 22.
Now, Jerome Kaino, if you watch him closely, he's not a man that reacts very often. He normally just gets on with the job at hand, right? But here, you can see his eyebrows go up and then a look of determination and anger set in on his face as Tranduk goes past him.
Yeah.
You can see him sort of be surprised and then determined to catch him.
Yeah. And it is the thing, like, you remember the clip of Shane Williams stepping back his Borta? And then Borta just thinking, like, I'm not having that, mate. And then coming back and nailing him, like, on the way past.
Yeah.
It was that kind of thing from Kano, and eventually the All Blacks do catch him, catch Tranduk, who shows an unreal turn of pace here. It's Whippu who actually makes the tackle. He does a diving tap tackle to stop Tranduk, and it is a try saver properly at that point because you feel like Tranduk is going over. He shows an insane amount of pace.
It is. It's 60 odd meters each. No, he sort of eats at 45 ish.
Yeah. But on the angle, you know.
Yeah.
He runs very far.
So there's a massive stink when he comes on full time after Parra goes back off.
Yes.
Because Parra comes back on for about 5 minutes, then really can't hack it, can't stand up. So he goes back off. Tranduk comes back on. And he has this real stink of, I'm a fly half. This is why it's useful to have one of us in your team. I'm going to try a drop goal. I'm going to kick for the corners. I'm going to try and organise the back line. And I'm going to throw an outrageous dummy and make a 60 metres.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a great moment for all game managers who've gone out of this World Cup when he just is an absolute masterclass for the first 10 minutes when he comes on.
He throws that dummy and says to Kaino, that was for Ander Monroe.
Yes. Oh, man, if only he played in this final. I'm gutted. But then France just kind of shit the bed a bit after this. And I feel like they really should have scored in the last 5 minutes of that half. There's a point where Vincent Clerc puts a kick out on the full and it's so poor. At that point, they're just backpedalling and you feel like they can create something. And I get that in the Wales game, we praised them for the fact that all of their backs were kicking really, really well. But at this point, I just feel like they lacked patience completely.
But it's interesting. There's a moment earlier on in the half, about 50 minutes in, where Moz does like quite a small little stab through and they make about 10 metres off it, but surrender the ball.
Yeah.
And that felt like a win at the time.
Sure.
Because it felt like they found some space and they slowed the game down and they kind of, you know, pinned the
probably wasn't enough on the kick, was
and
there?
Put some pressure on. There wasn't enough on the kick at that point, but it felt like, and he easily could have hit it another 10 yards because there was the space to do so.
Yeah.
But he just hit it and that still felt like a bit of a win because of how tight the margins in this game were.
Yeah.
As I said, towards the end of that first half, those kicks start to become slightly worse and things start to open up a bit more and suddenly they're not wins anymore.
No.
And 5% have dropped off the kind of kicks Mamoz was doing.
Absolutely.
And they're suddenly, because 5% is enormous in a game this tight.
France are really, really poor in the last 5 minutes of that half.
They did well to come out.
They play well throughout the rest of the game, but that was a really, really poor sort of period of 5-7 minutes.
If you're France looking at that, in a way, 0-0 is a stalemate, you know?
Sure.
Like, they were playing badly, but it was probably their best period of possession and territory since the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's just that they wasted a couple of balls, which is quite frustrating to look back on, you know. But they go in 5-0 down.
Try and do
kiss
one out in the full
as
well.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah, goes in 5-0. Whew! And, you know, we kind of breathe for the first time in 40 minutes. There's another moment, just quickly, when Piri Whippy misses that penalty towards the end of the first half. Grant Fox says on commentary, when you rotate that quickly to the left, you always swipe it.
What's that mean?
I don't know. It sounds like he's describing Piri Whippy like he's a rotisserie chicken.
I think rotisserie chicken was where he spent all his money at London Welsh.
That was it. That was where he was going. Where he was taking Diego Dusatoir out.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when you rotate that quickly to the left, you always swipe it.
Okay, sure. I mean, I have no idea what that means, but...
No, but thank you.
Yeah, cheers, Grant.
But I figure it just means he turns his hips in a weird manner.
Something like that. But I don't know the first thing about goal kicking, so...
So yeah, also, Richie McCaw gets penalised at the end of the first half, which is really exciting and really, really fun.
Well, it's funny you should say that. So, as they come up for the second half, the Australian commentators say, we've had a top-tier referee text us at half-time saying that McCaw is getting away with murder, and basically implying that Craig Joubert is not having a very good game. And that was Steve Walsh, wasn't it?
Of course it was. Of course it would be Steve Walsh.
Yeah.
But
like,
no,
that was
Steve
definitely
not...
Steve Walsh.
Steve Walsh would let someone get away with murder.
Yeah. But Steve Walsh clearly, like, is the sort of referee who would go to a pub and critique the referee. Is like, by the way, did you know? I'm actually a top-tier referee and businessman.
But who would... No, it would be a referee who probably refereed them when they were playing.
Maybe.
Or someone I guess they've done punditry with, but I don't think it'd be Steve Walsh.
But they
Steve Walsh is also a Kiwi. So.
Oh, that's true, actually. Yeah.
You know.
Maybe it's not Steve Walsh.
Why would Steve Walsh, say, be harsher at the breakdown?
Yeah, no. Maybe it wasn't Steve Walsh. But yeah, I just thought it was an interesting point. My immediate thought was Steve Walsh, but...
You say ran out for the second half.
Yes.
Do you want to know what happened to me at the end of the first half?
What?
I mean, I mentioned I tried to put my phone back in action, though. But I left it to autoplay to move on to the second half, because there were separate videos, first and second half. And I was watching them on Daily Motion.
Sponsored by Daily Motion.
Instead, and Rotisserie Chicken, and instead, a Spanish soap opera started playing.
McCaw play in
this
that?
This is quite a shift in tone for Richie McCaw. Like, Dusatoir, still spellbinding in it. Still an excellent and very physical performance.
Any spoilers from the Spanish soap opera?
I watched about a minute. So there was a princess in it who got saved, and there's like a princess crying in like a big bedroom.
Okay,
was like the bit I managed to watch.
It's a way to break you down from that breathless first half, isn't it? That should have been a half-hour entertainment and analysis. To be fair,
he should have brought that out. See how it went. Yeah. So then I eventually did look around and find the second half, and it turns out there were significantly fewer crying Spanish women in the second half.
That's a shame.
There was eventually one crying France.
I love crying Spanish women. What?
Let's leave that in. So we have a second half that begins and Piri Weepu kicks off and things start to get a little bit wobbly for the All Blacks.
Yeah.
I think it is Richie McCaw gets penalised.
Yeah.
And everyone panics and goes, is that allowed? Is that allowed to happen?
Tranduk does more mad shit. Does a loop followed by a switch, like in the same movement,
yes.
Which is brilliant. It's a great start for France. Yashvili steps up and takes a penalty, which he's deliberately not been doing because of his injury to his left foot, which is happens to be the one he hits off. But he takes it and he narrowly misses, and that's actually a good strike. You look at that one and think, okay, he's going to get one at some point. But
looked like it was over.
It did.
I think more so than the James Hook one on first viewing. Mm. The famous James Hook one from the South Africa game. I then went back and watched it back and fade ever so slightly.
Yeah,
wide.
Yeah.
It's just the angle you're watching it at from. Yeah. It looks like it goes
He does miss it narrowly, but it's a really good strike.
Really close.
It's a lot better than anything Whipu's been pulling up. And I think that probably does ring alarm bells for the All Blacks a little bit, that like their discipline has to be so much better than France's does.
So, should we talk about Dmitry Yashvili?
Yeah. Happily.
I'd love to.
Yeah.
So, Yashvili, his first two real involvements in the game are both mistakes, right? Yeah. So he puts a kick out on the full, and then he throws a horrible pass to Maxi Meydal, who stood in the pocket to clear, and he hits it really, really badly.
Yeah.
And Maydal's left to panic, and he makes quite a good run out of it.
Yeah.
But from that moment onwards, shithouse mode engages.
Yeah.
And he is brilliant, and he is so petulant and annoying that he clearly channels all his frustration through himself and tries to unleash it and unload it onto all of the All Blacks.
For sure.
It's one of the most annoying performers you'll ever see from anyone. I thought he was brilliant.
The you know, dickhead because kicking is such a rare breed of rugby player. And, you know, we've spoken about, particularly I've spoken about my love for Emil Gysin, my favourite player in all of existence. There's a real air of that. Basically, I think that he is probably doing Chigashvili's role model, but despite the fact that this World Cup is before Ramil Gysin maybe even played rugby. But anyway.
Yeah, there's just a few Yashvili moments while we're here. Like, there's lots of kicking and lots of him just sliding it down into awkward position for the All Blacks or pinning them back. But there's one that I really, really enjoyed where the ball bounced off the All Blacks into touch. And it's quite a contentious, like, whose line-out would it be? You know, it's going to France.
Yeah.
And Yashvili runs in, takes the ball, and throws it straight into Richie McCaw's back, and then starts complaining touch judge.
I love that.
Yeah.
And Craig Gilbert says that you don't get a free kick for throwing the ball deliberately at him.
But
he's fuming. I love it.
That he starts complaining to the referee before it's even hit McCaw.
Yeah. Like, as he's motioning to pass the ball, he's already throwing his arms in the air, like, sir, what's he doing there? Come on.
I loved it.
That's a proper good moment.
Absolutely classic Yashvili moment.
Yeah.
And there's so many of them just dropped throughout the game.
Yeah.
There's another of him at a France get given the put into a scrum. And he starts complaining to the referee he wanted to play on. There's another where he, after the All Blacks are given a penalty, walks over to the referee, shakes his head and then walks off.
I feel like it was often when he was like, putting ball into scrums, or even Whippy was putting ball into scrums. I feel like he was always looking for something to complain about before the scrum was even set.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was fuming at Craig Joubert before the game even started.
He just hated people.
Yeah. He's a proper one of a kind, Yashvili.
And just as well.
Yeah.
You don't want a world full of Dmitry Yashvili.
Oh, Christ, that would be difficult to live in, wouldn't it?
One more, just like a classic Yashvili moment as well, of just like, there's another bit where he shoves Kieran Reid in the shoulder as he's trying to get to the ball after the giveaway penalty. And then we sort of see Reid walking away, and he kind of like, it looks like he checks his pockets. Like Yashvili's just stolen his mouth guard. Because Reid kind of does that thing where he starts like tapping himself.
I forgot.
Like he feels lighter. Yeah, and it looks like he does that, you know, like you see in con man movies. He puts one hand on his shoulder so you don't notice him putting one hand in his pocket. And I can just imagine Kieran Reid then playing the last 10 minutes without a mouthguard.
What I reckon happened was Yashvili put Kieran Reid's phone in his pocket. And so you think, like, why have I got this? Why is this not back in the changing rooms? You know, I reckon it's like reverse pickpocketing.
He gave him Freddie Burns' kicking tee.
Yes!
We finally know where it went.
I like to think that's what happened.
Yes, let's move on. I've exhausted my Yashvili chat.
I'm always here for it. I'm always.
I have one further note. I don't know what prompted it.
Go on.
It just says Yashvili is such a low shit. I love him.
Yeah, what a guy. What a good moment to end that segment on. That's a nice sentiment there.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
But France give away a penalty 30 metres out from their own try line in between the posts. And what should the All Blacks do but say, "Hey, Piri, fancy a go at this?" And then everyone else goes, "No, don't let that happen." And then up steps Beaver.
The Kiwi commentary really highlights Stephen Donald walking towards us confidently. And they keep saying, he looks confident, he looks ready, he wants to take this, he's very, very ready.
He's going to strike the superb. Well.
I've never felt such nervousness and intrigue and talk about a penalty between the posts 35 metres out before.
Yeah, and like so little trust that the best team in the world have somebody on the pitch. Just anybody who could maybe convert that. Or come close at least.
Because, let's not lie, it's an easy penalty.
Very. Obviously, like, I wouldn't slot it, but I'm not an All Black.
Obviously, I'm not saying I wouldn't have walked up final. I have kicked that penalty from that kind of position before.
Like,
right?
It's a kick that you'd expect any professional kicker to nail. Certainly international kicker. And most definitely to the stage where you're playing in a World Cup final.
We've seen Thierry Dustoit kick a goal. You know, he could do that.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, like, I you would back pretty much anyone on that pitch, maybe other than front rows at this point.
And Piri Whippu, to kick that goal.
And Piri Whippu. And yet there's such tension around it.
Yeah, yeah. And up steps, you know, an international fly half to take it. So Stephen Donald go through his kick routine and strikes the ball in a really strange manner. He clearly wasn't doing the whole weird hip turn shanky thing that Grant Fox was on about. But he does it a little bit better than Whippu because somehow that ball allegedly goes through the posts. I believe that it does, but it doesn't look like it from the angle they show on TV, does it?
Yashvili striked his a minute earlier so much better.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he missed it.
Yeah.
Which just goes to show that, you know, deserves got nothing to do with it.
Yeah. But it squeaks through. It does go through somehow.
It looks like it's going wide. It's kind of one of those where the ball wobbles and fades a bit, but it happens to wobble and fade just as hitting the post and goes in straight and then fades back out.
I have no idea how that kick does go through the post, but it does somehow.
Yeah.
Like, as it leaves his boot, you think no part of you think that kick is going to be successful. You think, oh my God, he shanked it. And somehow it goes through and sends the All Black 8-0 up in the World Cup final!
It's that kind of thing of, like the American pundit was saying at the start, it's a team of destiny.
Mm.
And Stephen Donald did his best to ruin that. And just like God had to reach down and go, "No, come on, Stephen." And nudge you ever so slightly.
This is the final, Stephen.
Like, we've talked about this, Stephen. Yeah. You're not white baiting now.
And
keep the fishing.
I mean, if any, you know, it's a pretty good story. Someone should make a film about it.
Well, this was it. Like, somehow, meanwhile, somewhere in Auckland, you've got a room of TV and film producers sitting watching this game, presumably all wearing baseball hats and sunglasses.
Yeah, or maybe Power Rangers morph suits.
One of them turns to the next one and goes, "I've got a pretty good idea."
Yeah. And
get the guy from Power Rangers on the phone.
Who knows? Someday we might talk about that in depth. We'll see, but we'll leave that as a cliffhanger on the final. So after that, Damien Trye comes on for Vincent Clare, which is a shame. Yeah. that Claire has to go off. Because he'd been playing well. Obviously, there was that criticising for that kick out on the fall earlier, but generally, he was running very well.
Mm.
And he's the sort of player who can finish tries from anywhere, but he's also very sensible. So yes. Him going off is obviously a big loss. So Maxime Medard moves the wing, and Try moves the fullback.
Yes, and France regather the kickoff, and I have one last point to make about Dimitri Ashvili.
Yeah.
He would have hated the 5-second ruck rule.
Oh, yeah, of course he would.
Because
if it was 50 seconds, he'd hated it.
Yeah, where he just luxuriates. He lies down, gets out his sunglasses so he can be one of those TV producers in Auckland, and just has a good time. And I genuinely, looking at this, don't think it harms the game.
No, that's it.
Because I don't mind it being one long ruck rather than the team being forced to play three phases doing nothing.
So there's a point where Craig Joubert calls Yashvili over and basically says, like, mate, I don't appreciate you time-wasting here. You know, you need to use the ball a bit quicker. It's like, no, he's not time-wasting. That's just the speed Yashvili got. That's his top speed. That's just the way he plays. Like, why would he be time-wasting? They're 8-0 down. Like,
No, of course he's time-wasting. It's Dimitri Yashvili.
But it's not for the reasons Joubert's accusing him of, you know?
No, yeah.
It's just like, no, that's just the speed he plays at. Like, have you not seen him play before?
Yeah, so they eventually do kick the ball, clear it, get into the All Blacks half. And... well, so New Zealand have a weird moment.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's because they've gone 8-0 up and they've got a bit of confidence and they start doing the kind of things they do in autumn internationals where they then just pull away against Scotland or Wales. But that's kind of where their brains are at. And they've thrown a few little passes in a row. They've got caught in their own half and Aurelien Rougerie goes into a ruck and manages to make a real mess of it and knock the ball away from Mononu's feet.
And you say the All Blacks have a weird moment. Specifically... Piriwipu has a weird moment and he decides to, and we've seen scrum halves do this successfully before and it worked, but they pick their moments. So Piriwipu sees that the ball is on the floor and instead of scooping it up or diving on it, he thinks, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pass this ball to the next person via my foot. So I'm going to kick the ball up as like a kick flick up to the man stood next to him. I'm not sure who it was. Maybe Kahui.
Conrad Smith. It might be Kahui.
Someone like that. And he just fails to acknowledge that Francois Trandouk is perfectly stood in between those two players. And he's not quite. He perfectly runs onto the ball. He stood in perfect position to intercept that pass, which is exactly what he does. So Whipu goes for that kick flick up pass type thing. And
I mean, it's ridiculous anticipation from Trandouk.
It's unreal. Unreal to think, oh yeah, Piriwipu, who has been, you know, having a mixed bag of a game, is going to try this speculative thing and he's going to get a good enough kick on it that it's going to go perfectly into my midriff. Like, Francois Trandouk managed to predict that perfectly and then sprint most of the way to the try line. And he
gets up about the 22.
Yeah, he outpaces most of the All Blacks.
Crosses the 22 metre line.
Yes. Yeah. And then flings the ball over his head to Yashvili.
Yeah, who then loses footing from under him. Yashvili would have... you figure that's like... he's either scoring or he's being stopped on the try line.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? But he loses his footing regathering the ball and falls over on the 22.
It's quite smart the way that he goes about this, actually, because he then sort of lets the whole All Blacks defence kind of overtake him and think, like, let's turn this into an overlap rather than a line break opportunity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he thinks about it very tactically. Rougerie has a great carry up the middle. I think maybe Aaron Nordicke's had a bit of an offload as well, but Rougerie batters into the All Blacks defence and gets France up to 5 metres of their try line.
They work it in field a bit, then they go wide because they have a bit of an overlap, but unfortunately in the 13 channel is William Servat, who kind of panics for a moment. Then by the time he's thinking about and able, got his hands in such a place he can make the pass, it's no longer on. You know, the All Blacks,
and he has a look of regret as soon as he goes, like, oh, I'm going to get criticised. We're going to get turned over. I should have passed that ball.
So he smashes it up, takes it in, and France kind of won. They're still on the line. They're still really, really close. But you wonder, they've just blown two clean-cut opportunities. Is that it?
Yeah.
Thierry Doucetois, however, is still on the field.
Yeah, he still exists. So France worked back to the midfield. I think is it Aurelien Rougerie gives the last pass?
And they Trandouk calls it out right away.
Yeah.
Right from that phase. And they, throw it right into Rougerie, who waits until Doucetois runs a superb tip online.
Great
in between the two.
Yeah.
I have, watching this back, I have absolutely no idea what Israel Dagg is doing.
He's kind of stood on the outside, right?
So he's the guy. So obviously someone comes in on Rougerie
to
make that tackle, right? And he waits until that guy's decided he's on Ruggeri waits until the guy's decided he's on him rather than committing or being able to drift between him and Deuce Etoile. Deuce one thing goes right through. Dag has not pushed up and joined the line. Dag is kind of behind, basically in the fullback channel.
Yeah.
Then whoever's outside him is marking on his position instead. So there's no cohesive line at all.
Yeah.
And it allows Deuce Etoile to go really cleanly.
Yeah.
He's basically running straight at the post, but instead of doing a Haskell, he grounds the ball on the far side of it.
Because Dag manages to slightly clip his ankles a little bit, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And Deuce Etoile manages to sort of like slide onto his knees and ground the ball one-handed. It looks like quite an unnatural finish, but obviously it's exactly what he needed to do. And then, so he scores, it goes to 8-5.
It's now such an iconic finish as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I guess, the second best remembered try Deuce Etoile ever scored against the All Blacks. Maybe should be the first. Yeah, and then Istranduk actually converts the try. He takes it back to the 22 for some reason.
Weirdly tense conversion to say it's literally in line with the post.
Yeah, and for some reason he takes it back really far. But, you know, he converts it. It goes up to 8-7, so they're fine. But, you know, if you're an All Black, you think, no worries. We're still a point up. And now what we're going to do is we're going to... we've got the kickoff, so we're going to boot it into the French half, right? And tackle them somewhere down there. Right?
Yeah. It's just a good idea.
Yeah.
Just a good...
Or alternatively, we could have Piruwipu take the kickoff.
Idea. And that does not go particularly well for the All Blacks. This is, as I said... There's a period in that second half where the All Blacks look properly rattled for the first time.
Yeah, they look shit for about 5 minutes.
A lot of the narrative around this World Cup, especially this final, was that the All Blacks were rattled and didn't quite know what they were doing.
Yeah.
And they let a French team who were, as you said, the worst team to ever play in a World Cup final, into this game.
Yeah.
I think actually they were very competent for the first 45 minutes.
I agree with you.
They then pretty much fall apart for about 5-10 minutes.
Yeah.
As you say, so Ripu in particular puts that kick out on the full.
Directly after the try. And directly after he had set up that run for Tranduk. Like, Wipu has... The All Blacks fans are after his head at this point. And as soon as he puts the kick out, Graham Henry just shepherds crooks him. And he's like, you're off, mate. And Andy Ellis comes on in his place.
Yeah, so they... The scrum takes quite a while to set. There's like a one of those long sort of water breaks because, the ball and play time has been so high.
Yeah.
They take a longer than usual stoppage there. And in that time, that's long enough for Graham Henry to get the message down and say, Piri, no.
Yeah.
No. Head to the bench. We've got a monster munch waiting for you. You can eat it there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it probably feels like the All Blacks are about to shit the bed at this point, doesn't it? As France get a scrum on halfway. And the French scrum, they weren't dominating yet by this point, but they were looking fairly comfortable in the scrum.
The further the game goes on, the more and more France are on top in the scrum.
Yeah.
Because the All Blacks get a couple of technical penalties in the first half for them. But the moment scrum starts to be completed
France
and
tires,
the ball stays in, France become on top. And for whatever reason, the All Blacks decide to leave both their props on for 80 minutes.
Yeah, that's a really
interesting
call.
Whereas Parcella comes on around 50 minutes and actually makes a difference, you know, and kind of sharpens them up.
I mean, I thought it was a really weird point because Lievremont brought on Barsea and Sarzewski both just after their props had won a penalty and dominated and marched them back 10 yards. And that was the one where François Tranduc takes the penalty from like 50-odd metres out and is short. But yeah, straight after that scrum where they absolutely dominated them, for some reason they sub both their front rowers and I don't get it.
Well, it doesn't feel like Razzie doing it in the 2019 final.
No.
Where it was a statement, you know?
Yeah, it's like just as they're starting to properly dominate them, they change.
I wondered if it was... I think partly just Mark Lievremont being a weird man. But there's a part of it you can say it's for continuity, it's for making sure they don't tire themselves, they don't get to the point. But I said the All Blacks leave their props on for 80 minutes, you know?
Yeah. So,
but there we are.
Yeah.
And Servat was the kind of player by this point. It was right before he retired. This was the last game for France.
Of course, yeah.
He did begin to tire.
Yeah,
and you can see that in a few
naturally.
Games in the pool stage where he looked tired in the last 20 minutes.
So from the back of this scrum, France kick into the All Blacks 22. And Deuce Etoile looks like he's about to win the match winning turnover, doesn't he? Like, he basically Dag slips over inside his own 22. And Deuce Etoile just gets a completely clear path to the ball. And Ali Williams, honestly, that's maybe the best clear out of the whole World Cup. Or the most important, certainly.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Deuce Etoile is properly clamped over the ball, and you're thinking, this is the match-winning turnover he's about to get here. He's about to win his side of penalty. And Dag holds onto the ball for just about the amount of time that's legal as Ali Williams manages to clear out Deuce Etoile, and it's technically superb.
Williams' work rate is incredible.
Yeah, he makes a real impact.
He's been on the pitch a few minutes.
Yeah, he comes on for Brad Thorne, doesn't he?
No, for Whitelock.
Okay, yeah. But his work rate is insane. And there's a few like that where he hits rucks super, super hard and technically really, really well. I just have written down in my notes, Jesus, Deuce et Toi is everywhere. Allez, les bleus. Probably because that's what the crowd were chanting at that point. And then just All Blacks are not enjoying this. Deuce et Toi runs hard. No.
But it then starts to turn a bit. I think that is... The All Blacks clear that quite comfortably. Mm. They get up. France eventually knock the ball on.
Yeah.
And from there, the All Blacks start to go, no, actually, we've got this.
Yeah.
You know? And things change. And suddenly there's a period of 5 minutes where the All Blacks keep hold the ball from their own half. They make it up to the French 22. Mm. And they really look on top. Like, Stephen Donald makes a break. And, I mean, there's no such thing about it at all. He just kind of puts his head down and goes.
Yeah.
And he somehow manages to power through in a way 10s rarely do. Like, yeah. It is like Ander Munroe. You know, he is... Very
like
much.
A tribute act every 10, to Ander Munroe.
Every 10 in this World Cup is trying to emulate Ander Munroe.
Or Emil Gysin. Titanium 10. One or the other.
Yeah. Sure, but mostly Ander Munroe, the Titanium 10 himself. And it's just, it's like sheer determination rather than speed or balliness or anything that gets him through that gap. Like, it's just the absolute, whew, no. You know, it's not his ballet skills that got him through that gap.
Yeah, yeah. There's my favourite point with Stephen Donald. Is there's a point where he tries a dummy switch whilst he's literally off the field of play.
Yes.
Where, like, well, he tries a dummy switch with Corey Jane.
Mm.
And basically, it's one of those where your player is running towards the touchline, and so the winger correctly runs a switch line so they can keep the ball in. And Stephen Donald kind of forgets that this isn't him running a move with his 12. And he just keeps hold of the ball. And then eventually he realises that he's over the touchline and tries, like, throwing the ball over his head back into the field of play before realising, no, he's, like, 5 metres out.
There's a few moments like that. There's another one where Nonu and Dag play far too close to the touchline.
Mm.
And Dag ends up taking it out.
Sure.
Another one, Kahui gets put out and put in touch by Morgan Parra.
Yeah.
The All Blacks played some really risky rugby that coaches nowadays would not be happy with, playing that close to the touchline. There's a few things in this game that really stand out as a modern coach would hate that in a World Cup.
Yeah. It is quite bizarre. Some of the I mean, as I said, that Pape offload I mentioned earlier.
Mm.
Like, you wouldn't see that in a World Cup final now. It feels quite risky, but I guess it adds to the intensity that this game had, you know?
Yeah. Richard Kahui also lets the ball bounce a lot from kicks.
Yeah. Kahui was kind of like lucky to make it through this game without really making any errors.
Yeah.
I feel like if this game was 10 minutes longer, I feel like France would have exposed that a little bit more.
They'd put more pressure on him.
Yeah.
I feel like you probably could have. You know, he puts in the one kick, which is perhaps a poor decision.
Yeah.
As there's a couple of balls bounce, but yeah, he kind of gets through it.
Yeah. There's a point where he gets nailed by Deuce et Toi as well, which is fun.
And Maxi Madar makes like an incredible strip on him.
Yes.
When New Zealand
it's quite an important
really
one.
Good period of pressure. Yeah. And Madar comes in, he just moves the wing at this point, rips the ball away.
Yeah.
Power of his sideburns. Incidentally, did you see the picture of the French the Toulouse under 20 team that won the under 20s top 14?
No.
Under 20s French Championship. So, 2 points of note, right? One is the second under Mac playing.
Right, okay.
You know, Roman's younger brother, who's number 8. Mm-hmm. Was playing in that team. The other one is they had a fullback with sideburns.
Oh boy. Okay.
So
that's inspiring.
Can we now begin the transition of power?
Yeah.
From Maxi Madar to this fullback with sideburns, and Toulouse must forever have a back three player with massive sideburns.
And if they could develop a massive wanker to replace Yohan Uge as well, then that would be much appreciated.
It was very like, tell me Maxime Maidar's your favourite player without telling me Maxime Maidar's your favourite player.
Yes, absolutely.
And he had those massive brown sideburns. So yeah, so Maidar uses the sideburns to rip the ball out.
Yeah.
France regather it and they stick it back down into the opposition half.
Yeah.
There's another moment around this period where Julien Bonnaire just like knees Kieran Reid in a ruck.
Oh, I noticed that, yeah. I thought, well, I guess that makes up for the McCaw one earlier, but Bonnaire's was a little bit more calculated than...
Like, yeah.
McCaw's was.
Because he's brilliant, because he both knees him in the head in, you know, an attempt to hurt an opposition player that's playing incredibly well. And also, he's trying to highlight to the referee that he's in an offside position.
And that's the main thing. And like, there's a point where both French flankers just decide they're going to start rucking, as in using their studs.
Yeah.
And there's a point where they just both start doing that. And like, Deuce et Toi in particular is just completely, like, giving a few stripes to, like, most of the All Blacks.
He just stands on Conrad Smith at one point. He just sticks his foot in.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I mean, yeah, Doucetoire then just kind of realises, lads, we're losing. This isn't right. Punches a couple of holes in the All Blacks' defence. There's a point where Rougerie nearly sends Memoirs through a gap. But the All Blacks' defence just stays resolute. And at this point, there's probably about 5 or 6 minutes to go. And France had a four-minute passage of play.
Yes.
Like, it was just non-stop for 4 minutes, that ball and play time.
Yeah. No, it's mad. They've got another period before that where France get into the 22 after Dag shanks a clearance.
Yes.
And they try to run a crash ball. I think it's Memoirs crashing it up. Loses the ball, but loses it backwards. Another player regathers it, he loses it backwards. Another player regathers it, he loses it forwards. Yeah. And it just felt like this could be the moment, you know? That could have been it if they were just calmer and more careful with the ball. And World Cup swing on moments like this. You know, as we said, this game came down to so many tiny little bits.
And that was and a big bit one.
They
big
had one. A real chance to drop a goal there, or to even set up and look for a try.
Yeah.
And instead, they just failed to look after the ball.
Yeah. You're right. That's absolutely the moment that, you know, this is at the time, the biggest game of rugby that's ever happened.
Yeah.
And you're right. The ball remaining in, I think it was Lionel Nale's grasp at that point, could have just meant that they leak a penalty out of the All Blacks, and Yash Philly would have certainly stepped up and taken that, you know.
Tron Duke hit his previous drop goal attempt so well.
Yeah.
You know, like, he could have nailed another one. Could have had a Wilkinson or Stransky moment.
Yeah.
But, you know, no. He has another moment, Tron Duke, not so long after that, where the All Blacks get back into the half.
Mm.
And France, Doucetoire, obviously. No, it's Bonnet. Bonnet wins a penalty just outside the French own 22. You know, like 26, 27 metres, maybe, from their own line. And Tron Duke absolutely goes for broke.
Mm.
And he very narrowly misses touch from what would have put them 10 metres up on the line. Would have been a phenomenal kick.
Yeah.
Like, better than Weepoo's in the first half.
Yeah.
Misses by inches.
Yeah.
But I absolutely don't blame him.
No, me neither.
For that.
Me neither.
Because that is a moment that could win you a World Cup.
Yeah.
And take that shot rather than being conservative in the last 10 minutes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And France did try and go balls out in the last 10 minutes, didn't they? But the All Blacks just weren't having it. So, like, 5 minutes left, they bring on Sonny Bill Williams, and his job is very much to just no offloads, just be as sensible as you can, Sonny.
Like, there's a moment where, again, sort of with like 7 or 8 minutes to go, where Palisson burns Nonu on the outside, but gets tackled by the core into touch. Just managed to offload it in time, but the ball still goes into touch afterwards. And it's just, you have so many of those little beats where a French player is doing something really great and using... It's almost always a player doing the thing they're known for.
Mm. Yeah.
So you had, you know, Maidar has a little, in the first half, has a little, like, steppy run where no one can quite lay a finger on him, and anyone that does still can't quite wrap around him. You have Memoirs being sort of physical but getting off.
Memoirs
was
a
Rougerie, like, really, like, doing that thing where he hits the acceleration right before contact and powers on. You have Palisson, managing to burn two French players on the outside. Vincent Clerc making more space than he should on a little run. There's so many times where the French, you know, Arnautovic linking up out wide as well. So many moments in that, especially the last sort of 15, 20 minutes, where France were able to get their players doing the things you want to see from them. But every time, whatever comes next then doesn't quite follow through. Whatever comes should come next doesn't.
So, speaking of what Justin Marshall would coin micro moments, on comes Jean-Marc Doucin. For his
first... Why have you moved so far ahead? There's so much we haven't covered. Yeah, so I mean, we haven't covered the penalty.
We have.
10 minutes to go.
Okay, well, let's do that.
So, France absolute, as you said, about questioning why Barcella or Sardeski come on. With about 13 minutes to go, they absolutely smash a scrum just inside the All Blacks on half.
Yeah.
And win a penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And France think... We've got to go for it.
Yeah.
We've got to go for
it. So Tran Duke steps up to take it, doesn't he? So not the recognised kicker necessarily, but clearly Yashvili thinks this is outside the range I'm capable of with this injury.
This is the longest kick Francois Tran Duke attempted in his French career.
Wow. That's a hell of a stat, that is.
49 metres.
Yeah, but who can blame him? You know, that could be the winning shot in the World Cup final. And if he managed to find an extra few metres, he could have been the hero.
He is smiling. You know, obviously there's boos coming down from all over. He is smiling as he takes the run up, as he's looking at it.
Yeah.
And as part of trying to do kicking stances, he has a really short run-up. He takes basically one step off the ball and then
it looked quite unnatural, didn't it?
Yeah. And I think he clearly is really adapting for technique because he has the distance, but it's well wide.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, you don't blame him, and he strikes it as well as he could have, likely, as someone who isn't a recognised long-range kicker, but manages to make the 50 metres up anyway.
Yeah. But, alas, it falls short. The All Blacks have no choice but to clear the ball.
Wide.
Oh, yeah, wide, sorry, wide. And, yeah, the All Blacks clear the ball. As I say, France sub their front rowers. And, oh, yeah, there's another point where Dag managed to get this brilliant, like, 50-metre clearance into touch from his own 22.
Yeah.
And that's a proper, like, saving the All Blacks bacon moment.
Yes. And there's a couple of, like, Damian Trai starts to make a difference with about 10 minutes to go. He makes at one point one really terrible kick, but then regathers it.
Yes.
So, you know, you can't blame him for that. He makes an incredible take where he rips it out of Israel Dag's hands in the air.
Yeah, and Dag was, like, complaining about it for some reason.
Yeah, but it's perfectly legal. It's perfectly grand.
Stephen Donald does a really good kick as well.
Yes, he does.
Where he gets it just outside the French 22. Yeah.
But right after Trai regathers and rips that ball out of Dag's hands, just outside the All Blacks 22, the ball comes loose and eventually it's given as, I think, a scrum to the All Blacks, whatever it is. Whatever it happens, right after the whistle is blown, the ball kind of comes loose, spills out. Yashvili hacks it on, and then instead of regathering it, he goes to do a slide tackle.
Yeah.
And he puts the ball on and kind of trips up Corey Jane, who's coming across to try and stop
it. That was pretty mental. Was that after the whistle had gone as well?
It was after the whistle.
Yeah.
After the whistle. He just does a slide tackle on Corey
Jane.
That
guy's such a colossal knobhead, isn't he? I
love him. This all moves us on to, as you were saying previously, that kind of final 5 minutes.
So yeah, Jean-Marc Doucin comes on for his test debut in the World Cup final for Yashvili, who's having a really good game. You can only imagine Yashvili just physically could not carry on any longer because he's been all over the park at this point. But yeah, I don't know the rationale behind the decision. I genuinely think Mark Lee Averyman would have taken pride in putting somebody on for the test debut in the World Cup final, I think, because he had this whole maverick facade that it's not even a facade, it's just a narrative.
Yeah. It's just
like
facts.
He capped his younger brother just because it would appease him.
His mum.
And his mum, yeah. But anyway, Jean-Marc Doucin comes on, puts the ball into scrum, which is his first touch for France, and passes the ball on to Tranduc. They have a bit of an attack up the middle of the field. And then Doucin comes in for his second touch of the ball for France, and he knocks it on. And you feel like experienced scrum half Dmitry Yashvili would have managed to keep that and give a crisp pass.
Yes.
And it's just like, this is exactly why you don't put somebody on for their fucking test debut in the fucking World Cup final in the
is
last
that
5 minutes. Because
is that the reason? Because I've always wondered.
Because
they
might
why.
Not do very well. Like,
it's
complete madness by Lee Averyman to do that.
Right, but okay, so I was watching BT Sport, right, the week before the 2019 World Cup final, and all I could think when we got to the final itself was England would have won that if Marcus Smith had started.
Oh, that's a good point, actually. Yeah. Yeah, or maybe Alex Dombrandt.
Yeah, Alex Dombrandt would have won the World Cup single-handedly.
Yeah.
Like, you could have just entered Alex Dombrandt as 21st country and he would have won the World Cup.
Yeah, it's a really
maybe
good point.
Maybe Sam Simmons would have beaten him.
Yeah.
But, you know,
yeah.
You can't get into that.
But annoyingly, he has caps, so. Yeah.
But yeah, so Doucin shits the bed. I want to give credit in that ruck to Richie McCaw.
Who
barrels the entire French team over and spills the ball out.
Of course,
really ugly,
of course,
so
yeah.
And
it's not the easiest pickup, but Yashvili still would have dealt with it, or any experienced international scrum half would have.
Parra would have dealt with it.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
like,
exactly.
Weepu or Ellis would have dealt with it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
David Mele would have
dealt with it.
David Mele would have dealt with it.
Yeah,
that's the name of that's a great like new sitcom. David Mele would have dealt with it. Would you have dealt with it as a scrum half?
No, because I don't think so. Because I may be a scrum half, but I'm not experienced at international level, much like Jean-Marc Doucin at this point. Like, if they put me on, I wouldn't have done a very good job. And you know what? I don't think it would have been a very good idea for them to pick me in the World Cup final.
Well, so you're not French. They would have got fined again for that separately.
That too. I probably wouldn't have got to the point where they're allowed to pick me. But
the other thing about Doucin
coming on, they picked David Smith, so
is,
who knows?
Yes. Doucin runs on. And he starts shouting and screaming orders at all the forwards instantly.
Like they're not already doing a great job. Yeah.
Can you imagine being Julien Bonnaire there? And going,
get
this
a load of
wanker?
This prick. Yeah.
Yeah, this like, prick who's just went on and starts screaming and telling us how to do our jobs. We've got to a World Cup final on our own.
Yeah.
And you, a 21-year-old kid, think you can tell us what to do?
No thanks, mate.
That's a moment in which as a scrum off, you don't want to tell your forwards what to do. You want to shut up.
Yeah. You want to tell them they're doing well, you know?
Yeah, you want to go, good job, let's keep it up.
Yeah.
Not start hitting more rucks, Julian, you lazy prick.
So, yeah, the All Blacks then just see it as an opportunity to wind the clock down. And why wouldn't they? So they are taking the full, like, 30-odd seconds over it every single phase. McCaw is completely at the centre of all of this and making sure everything is organised, everything's as they have practised. They're piling all eight forwards into all of the rucks to make sure there is no opportunity. Yeah. Aaron Aldicky keeps kind of trying to get his leg over to boot the ball out rather than trying to counter ruck, which, to be fair, is actually a pretty good tactic.
Bonaire does a great little one where he, like, lodges one foot into the ruck so he can then wiggle the other one about. And he manages to hit the ball, then the referee tells him to get away.
Yeah.
But I think he was fine.
Yeah, I think
he was perfectly all right.
But, you know, he forces McCaw to play the ball, I suppose. So
yeah,
it's an extra phase, therefore an extra opportunity to attack the ball. But it's a masterclass in the retention of possession from the All Blacks. And eventually they get a penalty, go to the touchline. And again, they're just thinking the same thing. Take this line out down, take as much time as we possibly can over it. And they do that brilliantly. They're into the 79th minute by this point.
Yeah, and they just keep playing very slowly until eventually it crosses 80.
Yeah.
And Dimitri Zarzewski goes, he just goes, oh, nothing wasted, isn't
it? Yeah.
And he shoots out offside and tackles Ellis before he can kick the ball
out. He's even reached to pick the ball up.
Yeah, like, take your chance, man. I'm all for that.
I love that.
Yeah.
Because, like, at the end of the day, regardless of whether it's legal, he's doing whatever he can to make sure he gets hold of the ball because he has nothing to lose. Otherwise, he's going to kick the ball out. They're going to lose the World Cup final. Like,
there is more chance of France winning that game if he shoots up offside and maybe he gets away with it than there is if he doesn't and the All Blacks can easily kick the ball out from right.
A 0.0001% chance he gets away with that because...
I think not. I think he's close enough that the hands have gone on the ball, that it hasn't picked it up, but the hands have touched the ball when he goes.
Yeah.
I think there is a maybe like 5-10% chance that some referees might let that go, especially with what we said about Craig Joubert being more lenient in the World Cup final. Yeah.
Good shit, Alzheimer's by Zarzewski, to conclude.
I think he's got like a 7% chance offside. Of getting away with that.
Yeah.
Absolutely all for it. Great work by Dimitri Zarzewski, but it gives the All Blacks a penalty, and it gives us a really weird split in celebrations. Because normally, one of the great things about rugby is that kicking the ball out at full time means that everyone celebrates at once, and you have a moment of actual unity, everything exploding, everyone going. However, you then have the split up, so the moment the penalty is given, Corey James starts celebrating the Winter World Cup. The moment the ball is kicked out, Richie McCaw starts celebrating the Winter World Cup. The moment the referee then blows his whistle, like 4 seconds later, and it signals the end, is your dad start celebrating they've won the World Cup?
The moment Dimitri Zarzewski shoots up, Andy Ellis starts celebrating.
Yeah. So you have, like four moments where the World Cup is won. Mm. And you have different players. And especially like you watch the... I watched back some clips from the Auckland Fan Zone of them watching this game. And they had thousands of people packed into fans, which just kind of goes to show the pressure that was on New Zealand of people coming down to not even watch at the stadium, not even watching at the local pub, people coming down to like a point on the harbour to watch that game. And no one quite celebrates at the same time. And it doesn't give you that really satisfying roar as the ball goes out. Yeah. You get like, you know, like England Wales in 2015 or something, where even South Africa in 2019, where you can see it all happen at once.
Yeah.
Instead, you get four moments of them all going, oh, but are you, hey.
Also, can we just talk about the fact that Andy Ellis like so like hogs the ball to make sure he's the one who kicks it out.
He is absolutely like, desperate.
That's a possible Dick of the Day nomination there. The fact that like he prevents, you know, like Stephen Donald probably would have wanted to kick it out, but I suppose maybe would have felt uncomfortable, so maybe would have said, Dag, you can do it. Or even Richie McCaw could do it, you know, as the captain. But instead Andy Ellis is like, no, I've spent so long thinking I'm the bench scrum half, I get the chance to kick the ball out in the World Cup final. And like genuinely, when that penalty is given, he shields that ball like his baby.
Yeah, he is holding, tucks
it under his jumper,
both arms flopped around. Yeah. There is no way anyone, the only person that could ever get it off him is Dimitri Yashvili.
Yeah, exactly. Or Sarzewski.
Yeah. But Sarzewski tried his best. Yeah.
But no, so Andy Ellis makes sure that he's the one who does it. He kicks the ball out and New Zealand win the 2011 Rugby World Cup.
Yeah, the celebrations, everything kicks off. The crowd lose it. They start cheering. Richie McCaw looks happy for the first time in his life.
Yeah.
I mean, even Dan Carter's happy in the stadium. Yeah. Graham Henry comes out afterwards and says, I feel so proud to be a New Zealander. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen Richie McCaw's interview.
Yes, I did.
The first thing he says is, I feel shagged, mate.
Yeah, I thought that was what he said. And I was kind of thinking, no, I must have misheard that. But
I'm absolutely shagged.
I mean,
is his first words after winning the World Cup.
Of course, there is another really iconic interview moment that happens at this point, and you know exactly what I'm about to say, don't you? With Thierry Dusautoir, or is it? When one of the, I don't know who it is, it's one of the New Zealand reporters, says, oh, I'm here with Thierry Henry, the French captain, and then carries on for a bit. And then he says, yeah, going back, Thierry Henry, the ex-French footballer, he would have been really proud of you. What?
Yes, he tries to
rescue
it.
It's like, no, mate, you got the guy's name wrong. Like, just own up to it and just say, sorry, mate, I mean, Dusautoir, you know, forgive me. And Thierry Dusautoir just kind of looks at him with disdain, just like, yeah. Why the fuck have you come up to me after I've played my heart out in literally the biggest game of my entire life, and you have the nerve to come up to me and call me Thierry Henry and then try and sell it out?
I just played a 9.5 performance.
Yes.
And you're going to call me... Is that what I need? The extra 0.5 and you'll learn my goddamn name? Yeah.
Honestly, the disrespect, man. That was awful, calling him Thierry Henry.
We then also see François Trandoute crying, just with his hands on his hips crying. Yeah. Which, bless him, you know, is that kind of... There's always two sides to it.
Yeah. So...
The other thing I saw here is Emil Untermat gets interviewed for some reason. And, I mean, like, I would have understood it better if he just spoke in French.
Yeah, he did struggle a bit, didn't he? At least they didn't send out Léa Vermont.
He talks too quickly for someone of his understanding of English. His English is clearly, like, conversational.
Yeah.
But he tries to talk so fast that he just muddles up every word and none of it sounds eligible.
It's quite bizarre. I don't really know why they pulled out Untermat, but, you know, whatever.
I guess just no one would listen to Léa Vermont.
Yeah, exactly. So it's next in line, I guess.
God, at this point, he had an 11-year-old son.
Oh, wow. That's mad to think, isn't it? Wow.
Yeah.
Watching on, thinking like, oh, my dad's not very good. Might become better than him.
Yeah, I need to do better than this.
Yeah. So the silver medalists of the 2011 Rugby World Cup are France. We'll talk about them first, then we'll talk about the All Blacks. Fair play to France, you know, they took a lot of criticism during the week and in the weeks leading up to this, but they played very, very well in the final. And they were really, really difficult to shift.
They absolutely saved their best at bat last.
Yeah.
The best they played in the World Cup and the second best and the third best and the fourth best were all rolled into that one final, you know?
Sure.
But the only thing that comes close is the last 10 minutes against Japan.
Yeah.
That's the only other time, which feels so long ago.
It does, doesn't it? Like, that's over a year ago.
Yeah. We haven't watching this at the time. It was just a month, like, and that felt like a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas here, we've got a year and a half.
Yeah,
what a it's way been to such spend a long time. A year.
I'm talking about all of So the gold medalists are the All Blacks on New Zealand, and Richie McCaw takes his gold medal, and you know the whole All Blacks squad take their gold medals, including Mills Moliaina and Colin Slade and Dan Carter, who all get great cheers from the crowd in Eden Park.
Yeah.
Before Richie McCaw lifts the Webb Ellis Cup aloft on his home turf, and you just got to think fair play to them, you know, that they so richly deserve that after waiting, how many years was it? So that was the 7th World Cup, they'd won the first one. Yeah, and so Richie McCaw lifts the Webb Ellis Cup, and, you know, they never live that down, and nor should they.
Looks satisfied for the first time in his life.
Yeah.
He's finally done it, he's finally made it, he's finally achieved the thing that he'd been working towards since he was 5 years old.
Yeah. Any last words on the All Blacks?
I mean, it's hard to argue if the All Blacks win the World Cup, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, they were the best team in the tournament.
Yeah.
And maybe they struggled at points. I hold they would have won this game against pretty much... They would have won against any of the four semi-finalists. Yeah. I think if they had to play that game against the Springboks, it's a different conversation.
Yeah, you're right.
Just because of what that Springbok team strength.
Yeah, at full strength especially,
Yeah, but it's hard to see beyond them as they were the best team in the tournament, they were the most consistent team in the tournament, and they put in probably, I think against Australia, maybe the best performance, other than the both teams in this final, but I think possibly them against Australia in the semi-final was the best and most dominant performance of the full World Cup.
For sure.
So I have no argument. I think New Zealand deserved to win the World Cup, and I'm glad I finally said that because so much of New Zealand's been waiting for closure because they felt like they didn't deserve it until I'd said it.
I mean, a lot of the time, people look back on this World Cup a lot less fondly than the 2015 one in terms of the All Blacks winning it because there was so much around it in terms of them struggling through this final and Dan Carter pulling out and all of the everything that had happened along the way. It was quite a tough road to victory for them, but they'd been so dominant in the previous 4 years of international rugby that, and beyond, that you know, it's you can't pick out another team and say they deserve to win it, you know?
No.
A lot of people say, and like in the, you know, I tweeted yesterday before we record this about the fact that I was watching this game, and I had a lot of French fans in my mentions saying this is the one that got away, this is the game that we should have won. And I think it's fair enough saying that France should have won this game, but New Zealand should have won this tournament.
Yes, they deserve to win. I completely agree with that. If France had won this World Cup, it would have been
such weird injustice. Yeah,
but if France had won this game, it would have been deserved because they were outstanding.
Yeah.
So it become, you know, there's a kind of conversation there. Mm. But I loved this game and I thought this tournament was so fun and so
it's good. Amazing.
And, you know, you kind of, because of the turning point it was in rugby, if it marked a shift from the last edges of the amateur era were being sanded off at this point.
Yeah.
And by the following World Cup, defences are so much more organised.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, a game like this World Cup final would have been so much more kicking based.
Yeah.
Whereas there's still these kind of like shreds of something different running here. And I think this World Cup final was the perfect mesh and the perfect changing of the guard type moment in terms of styles of rugby and the evolution of the game as it went on.
Agreed.
And in terms of having a full crowd that were all so into it and it being shown around the world and it being a big, big event in, you know, how many other countries you wanted to watch.
Yeah.
Especially, however, in New Zealand, where, you know, there was, we did mention this at the start.
Of course.
So, on the 5 terrestrial channels, this was broadcast, this match was broadcast live on 4 of them. On the other channel, your other option was Jaws the Revenge. So, join us next time for the Jaws the Revenge retrospective podcast, when we'll be looking over Jaws the Revenge in detail.
Yeah. Man of the Match and Dick of the Day, should we do that?
Do you know that, just quickly, the Michael Caine's story about Jaws the Revenge?
No.
So Michael Caine is in it. Michael Caine, who is a friend of the podcast and has been on the podcast before.
Of course he has, yeah.
Hence why I bring it up. I am Michael Caine. No, he infamously said, "I've never seen the film. By all accounts, it's terrible. But I have seen the house it bought me, and it's terrific."
Fair enough. Good quote. Yeah,
did it for the money. Fair play. just like all the All Blacks did, Richard McCaw only did this for the money.
Where should we start?
So, should we start with Dick of the Day?
Okay.
End on a positive.
Okay. So, for me, there's a few options.
Mm.
So, one of them is Israel Dagg for that kick to touch, or not.
Yes.
Jean-Marc Doucin has to take a bit of flack. But more so than that, Mark Lievremont's the one who chose to put him on the pitch and put him in that position. So, that's entirely fair. Stephen Donald for attempting that weird pass from out of the pitch.
Yes.
Like, I genuinely laughed out loud at that, and I would have even if this wasn't literally the World Cup final. But it's got to be Piru Whippu for kicking the ball straight into Franz Wachandik's hands and then kicking it out on the full straight afterwards, having already missed like 3 or 4 kicks at goal. It's got to be Piru Whippu. It's the World Cup final, man. I'm amazed that I had that many nominations at the final, by the way. That many people have managed to do something stupid by the final.
Can I mention, this is Piru Whippu's first Man of the Match or Dick of the Day nomination.
Really?
And it's in the final.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
And it's not the way I think people that remember this World Cup fondly thought it would have gone.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I had far fewer Dick of the Day nominations.
Okay.
A couple of them you've covered in terms of Dagg.
Yeah.
And Damien Trial, also skies a kick, but then he regathers it, so he rules himself out. And the doo-doo says, Thierry Henry, which is...
That's unforgivable.
Awful.
Man.
Yeah. Another Dick of the Day, right, is the phase clock.
Right.
So... when in the last, you mentioned this, that 4 straight minutes of France having the ball, right? They go up to 17 phases.
Yeah.
And that's in the last 10 minutes. And the phase clock on the scoreboard replaces the actual clock. So you can't see how long's left time-wise.
Right.
So you spend yourself just staring at it and looking up, and they don't bring it back. You can only see that it's 16 phases. I know, I worked that out because it was 15 a minute ago. But I don't know how long's left in terms of time, because you haven't had the phase clock up since it hits 5 phases.
That's fine when you're watching it on YouTube, but when you're watching it live, that's not great, is it?
No, exactly. So the phase clock is one contender for the dick of the day.
Mm-hmm.
I then had a couple
Can't wait for this to be Amp Finger.
And my dick of the day is Martin Rodriguez.
Yeah.
No, you know, so... there's lots of people it could possibly be. But at the end of the day, Mark Lievremont put someone on for their debut at scrum half for a scrum half who was playing incredibly, incredibly well and was very, very
the man you want to close a game out.
Yeah, a man who had dragged his club into the European final single-handedly a year earlier.
Yeah.
You know, like, knew how to play these games.
It's mindless,
and also,
isn't
like, that is just the headline in all of the shit Mark Leavemont had done. You know,
sure.
He'd isolated and pissed off his entire team to the point where they'd held a mutiny during the World Cup knockouts. You know, he'd been fired despite the fact he could have won the World Cup this day. He was still going to be fired from his job because everyone hated him. He publicly disagreed with Thierry Doustrois' account of what happened at the Arrowhead moments after his captain had said it. He then, like, didn't turn up to the press conference. He turned up to the press conference late and didn't give a reason. There's just, like, there's endless things. And so I can't look beyond the man of the match. The final last dick of the day for the 2011 Rugby World Cup is Mark Leavemont.
That's fitting.
And I don't think anyone could ever argue with
that. That's very fitting. I love that. Man of the match. This should be a little bit more straightforward.
Yeah. So for me, I think there's six players in contention.
Okay. Let's talk it through them.
I'm going to run through them. So you have the three French back rowers.
Yes.
You have Thierry Doucetoit, is phenomenal.
Yeah.
9.5. You have Imanol Arunordiki.
He's great.
Who was brilliant.
Yeah.
Pretty much stole every line out. You know, he was so good at the line out in particular. Then just kept popping around the pitch whenever they needed him. You have Julien Bonnet, who I thought was so annoying.
Yeah.
And was so close to taking it from me. I thought he was...
God, he was good.
Really,
yeah.
Really good.
Yeah.
I thought Kieran Reid was...
Played well.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Carried the ball really, really well. Kind of showed something the All Blacks had been lacking a bit, of someone direct, but still with the hands. They hadn't quite, you know, Victor Vito had played very well during the first few stages of the World Cup, but I thought Reid added something.
Mm.
I think Marnonu was excellent as ever.
Yeah.
I just think he's been almost flawless in the World Cup, in this World Cup, in a way that makes you have sheer disbelief that he'll get even better in 4 years' time. And then Dimitri Ashvili, I thought was... really, really very good and really just wound the All Blacks up and is a big part in them starting to crumble a bit as they went on.
Absolutely.
But then the other guy, I think ultimately, those are the six in contention for me, but it comes down to a 1v1, a two-horse race between the two captains, Richie McCaw and Thierry Doucetoit.
Yeah.
I think they were the two... It's fitting that they were the captains, they were the figureheads and they were the poster boys because they were the two best players on the pitch. I think McCaw did such a good job of disrupting France and so much of them failing to score more than once, despite the amount of territory pressure, and especially, like, they put so much pressure on, but also possession they had. You know, they spent a lot of time in the first half in particular just keeping hold of the ball. A lot of that was McCaw slowing it down, doing things like forcing the knock-on by Doucan, etc. I thought, McCaw was phenomenal. But, right, I still hadn't decided this when the game finished, who would be my man of the match between those two. And I knew it was a two-horse race. Doucetoit, what we've talked about at length, you know, brilliant. Endless tackles everywhere. Scores a try. Phenomenal. Always in support. At one point, takes Kieran Reid out really blatantly off the ball. And I loved that. Just like completely takes him out of the defensive lines. Great. But we then get to the post-match interview, right? With this absolutely neck and neck. And Richie McCaw was asked about Stephen Donald. And he said, jinkies, he was composed. And so, for using the word jinkies in a post-match interview moments after winning the World Cup, Richie McCaw is deducted points, and so my man of the match is Thierry Doucetoit.
Damn right it is! Yeah, I think that's entirely fair. I mean, for me, all the people you nominated, as well as Rougerie, I think Rougerie was phenomenal. But yeah, I agree. It's Thierry Doucetoit for me. I think the more closely you look at this game, the more and more Doucetoit kind of shines. And also the key moments just kind of centered around him. And I think that regardless of the fact that he's not done much in the rest of the World Cup or international rugby in 2011, he is deserving World Player of the Year.
Yes. Off the back of this one.
This one incredible one performance. He's world-class, man. Like, that was... That's up there with his performance in 2007. That just like, that's one of the best individual performances I've ever seen by any player, especially in defeat. He's untouchable for me. Doucetoit is insane.
Yeah,
so he's my man of the match as well.
Yeah. So, two votes for Thierry Doucetoit. Where does that leave him in the overall table of man of the match and dicks of the day?
Ooh.
I have now drawn up what is at present the full list of everyone who's had multiple nominations for Man of the Match and Dick of the Day. I've got a full list. as well as doing it by sorting by country and picking out a 15 of players with the most Man of the Match and Dick of the Day nominations.
Yes. So in the next episode, we're going to go over this, are we not?
Yeah. So we are going to come back to this next episode. We're going to pick this up next week and run through both the Man of the Match and Dick of the Days, tournament teams. We're going to name the Man of the Tournament and the Dick of the Tournament.
Yeah.
Each. We're going to decide all of this. We're going to run for our teams the tournament.
Try the tournament as well.
Try the tournament. We're going to look back on the tournament in full as it was and reflect on this this endeavour of watching all 48 Rugby World Cup 2011 matches back in full.
So we've finished the World Cup now, but we are going to eke out one more episode dedicated to this World Cup where we wrap everything up, we reflect on it, and we just think about good times, you know?
Yeah.
Good vibes.
And in that episode as well, we are going to announce which World Cup we will be doing next.
Yes.
And between now and then, we're going to do a mini-series on another thing that isn't a World Cup.
Yes.
Retrospective, looking back on that. We'll be naming that in next week's episode on wrapping up the World Cup. The retrospective retrospective.
Yeah. I'd just finally like to say, you know, I hope you tune into that next episode. That should be a lot of fun. But yeah, thank you to anybody who's listened to this far. I know we've gone 2 hours in, and just generally throughout this has been a really great experience watching this World Cup back. It's obviously it's something we always have thought fondly about, and doing this podcast has been so much fun. So yes, I'd like to thank you, Robbie, for having me on for this full series. Obviously, people didn't come for me at the start. People came for you. And they've stayed for me, obviously. I'm now the face of this.
There's no real complaints.
And that's just the way it is. I'm sorry about to steal all of your audience and that they no longer like you. But no. Thank you for having me on for doing all of this. It's been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed every episode, apart from this one.
Right, okay, no, fine.
Wales France was a slog, but yeah. No, this has been a lot of fun. So thank you to everybody who's listened and whatnot. And we'll see you next
time. Thank you to everyone that's listened. Thank you to you yourself. Thank you especially to Rhiannon Garth-Jones, Sam Lana, Adam Jenkins, Ali Stokes, Cammy Black, Blaine Scully, Rhiannon again, Gareth Mason, Tom Savage, Ben James, Nick Heath, Sam Lana again, Sav from Linebreak Rugby, Jamie Wall, Graham Love, the Dale brothers from Draft Rugby, Sam Roberts, Elgin Alderman, Connor Trainer, Canada International, Chris Corcoran, Wales Touch International, Lee Calvert, Josh Gardner for being guests on the podcast and being such wonderful ones at that.
Yeah. And P Money.
Thank you to P Money for being our sponsor. Thank you to Ander Monroe for letting me fall in love. And thank you to yourself, William, for the podcast. But thank you mostly to everyone that's listened and has engaged in such as Deacon Marley fan fiction.
Yes.
That's been the real joy of this.
We're no doubt going to repeat all of this again next week, but bring it on.
So, all right, we'll see you then for that. Thank you, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.